The hour of 4:30 having arrived, the Conference Committee on House File 92, Senate File 3 will come to order. We are going to start with a side-by-side from staff. Just a couple of announcements at the beginning. We have a long list of testifiers. It's my understanding that the Senate intends to convene a hearing tomorrow in the afternoon. For those of you who need to leave, can come back at your convenience or want to recruit others to join you. It's also likely that the House or Senate will be convening additional hearings Monday and or Tuesday next week. We want to make sure that everybody who has something to say has an opportunity to do so. We have a list that we'll be following, and it's my understanding that those of you who may have time limitations based on childcare or having traveled some distance have had a chance to talk to the committee administrator, Matthew Bergeron, about your order of testimony. If you have something that is pressing that prevents you from staying until you're a spot on the list, please talk to one of the pages, and they will let us know, and we will try to accommodate that. However, if you just don't feel like sitting around here any longer and you want to jump the order, you're going to have to come up with a pretty good excuse. We're also going to ask folks to try to... We have a lot of testifiers. I know that there are a lot of people on this list who are for or against various aspects of this bill. In general, we'd like to try to keep the testimony to 2 to 3 minutes. If you feel like you have something that is compelling that hasn't been addressed, please address that in your testimony first. To the extent that you are raising issues that have been raised by others, probably assume that we've heard the first time. But we don't want to make anybody feel like they can't say what they came here to say, but be mindful that everyone is trying to get a chance to get a word in about this issue. And we have had extensive hearings last session when these bills were moving through and in the interim. So I think the issues are well known. And just keep that in mind as you're coming forward to testify. So, Senator Eaton, do you have any other announcements or things we need to hear first?
No, I just think we need to hear from the people.
Great. Welcome, Senator Hayden.
Thank you, sir.
Before we...
Oh, there he is here.
Well, I think we can just jump in. I think Ms. Newman is going to walk through the side-by-side. If members have questions along the way, just let us know and we'll interrupt and address those points as we go through.
Mr. Chair and members of the conference committee, I will go through the Senate or the House changes, and Mr. Fuller will then go through the Senate changes that line up. So on the side-by-side document that you have, Section 1 of the House bill, the House phases, first of all, it changes the threshold that divides a large employer from a small employer from the current level of $625,000 a year to the federal level of $500,000. And then in later on down on page R1, you can see the House wage changes that go into effect. So for large employers, now those would be those with $500,000 in business activity in a year, they would pay $8 an hour the first year, $9 an hour the second year, $9.50 the third year, and then January 1st of the fourth year, those wages would be indexed to the rate of inflation as determined by the Consumer Price Index. However, just a word on the inflation rate, there is a 2.5% limit on that inflationary increase that would be allowed under this. Small employers would go to a rate of $9.50 an hour the first year, $7 an hour the first year, $8 an hour the second year, $8.50 the third year, and then in the fourth year the inflation adjustment would kick in. On page R2 of the House language, this is the training wage. That would increase from the current level of $4.90 an hour to $6.50 the first year, $7.50 the second year, $8 per hour the third year, and indexed to inflation beginning in the fourth year. And then the language on lines 2.18 to 2.32, or additional language, 2.18 to 2.20 says, that an employer can't displace an employee in order to compensate for the changes in wages or to hire an employee at the reduced wage for the training wage. Lines 2.21 to 2.28 sets out the inflationary increase, and again, that's the consumer price index for all urban consumers. And the limits of the 2.5% or the rate of inflation, whichever is less, is contained on lines 2.25 to 2.28. Lines 2.29 to 2.32, I believe, were amendments on the House floor so that the reimbursement rates for social services would reflect these changes in the minimum wage.
Mr. Chairman, members, go back to R1. The Senate changes actually stop on the next page. So you go down to 1.16, and the Senate, now the dates are all, I mean, we've moved a year ahead, so that'll have to be a decision. But the three-phase increase for the large employer, as Ms. Newman explained, to $775 in 2015. There is no increase in the small employer rate. Those changes there are just to get rid of some obsolete language. The training wage on page R2 at the top is increased by a quarter, 4.9 to 5.15. The Senate has no inflation adjustments. If you drop down to 2.4, there's a new wage for those under 18 years of age, a cap for large employers of 7.25. What that means is if the regular large employer rate goes above 7.25, the wage for those under 18 would stay at 7.25 unless it was also changed. Clause E there at the bar, paragraph E 2.7, has a somewhat similar motivation as the language on E on 2.29 as the House, but it identifies a particular class of employees who, if they're allowed to sleep on the job, shall be compensated at the minimum wage set by the federal government, meaning if the federal wage is lesser, they could be paid lesser than a higher state minimum wage.
Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, then the House has several other provisions that the Senate doesn't have. The bottom of R2 and onto the top of R3 is language related to tips that are paid via credit and check cards. It brings some rule language into statute. And then on lines 3.7 and 3.8, it specifies that when a tip is given on a credit or a debit card, the full amount has to go to the employee rather than any sort of deduct by the employer. Section 3 on page R3 would align the state threshold for when overtime kicks in with the current federal law threshold of 40 hours a week. Section 4 relates to motor vehicle sales persons and mechanics and strikes language relating to commission and other incentive payments. And this was department language. Section 5 on R3, and onto the top of R4 is the change to the 40-hour threshold for overtime that would apply to air carrier employees. Section 6 on R4 is an exception, a temporary exception at this point, to the 40-hour-a-week overtime standard for agriculture employees. And the reference, the definition of agriculture contained in this is the definition of agriculture that's currently in rule. Under this language, the commissioner would have to do a study and make recommendations on the 40 versus 48-hour work week. And this subdivision would expire under this current bill February 1st of 2014, but that would be one of those dates that would be adjusted. Section 7 in the House language is the current the parental leave language that would align to similar to what the federal language, or it's the federal threshold of 12 weeks instead of 6 weeks for the duration of the leave. Section 8 is a conforming change to the 12 weeks rather than the current threshold of 6 weeks under the current state law. Section 9 on page R5 is repealer language relating to the gratuity language that is moved into the statute and out of the rule.
Thank you, Ms. Newman. Representative Metza, you have something?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. I was just wondering if I could get the room in just a show of hands. How many people here make over $6.15 an hour? And I just want you to have a thing to think about while we're doing this. For those who do make over $6.15 an hour and are having a hard time making their bills, I think it's a good thing to think about what we are fortunate for. So,
Mr. Chairman.
And Representative.
Mr. Chairman, to that point.
Senator Thomasone.
I want to point out that none of the legislators raised their hands.
Senator Thomasone, I think we were interpreting the question of which ones of us believe we're worth at least $6.15 an hour. Representative Metz, I just want to mention that we're probably not going to encourage a great deal of audience participation here tonight. And in general, we probably want to try to keep the focus on the testimony of folks coming in. So I appreciate your point, but let's not encourage rowdiness here, okay?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to get it out of the way in the beginning.
Thank you. All right, anything else from members of the conference committee? Very well, we will start with the first testifier on the list, Chris Jacobs. And just a reminder, we are seeking to keep the testimony to about 2 to 3 minutes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Jacobs. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Jobs Now Coalition. We are 100 organizations statewide, community, nonprofits, labor, faith-based organizations, and direct service organizations who ignore their differences to focus on what they have in common, and that is their belief that all Minnesotans who work ought to have the opportunity for a decent life. When we perused who was coming to testify today, I realized that I needed to put aside some brand new information that I don't know if the committee has seen yet. The Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development has a preliminary report on the Minnesota Cost of Living Study 2014 annual report. And I wanted to give you a couple of those numbers before I launch into what I was going to talk about today. In Hennepin County, a family of four, in order to meet their basic needs of food, housing, health care, child care, and utilities, would have to earn $18.53 an hour, and that's if your employer pays your health insurance. So that's the new number, $18.53 an hour. Just by contrast, I'll tell you about Blue Earth County. In Blue Earth County, that wage is $13.74 an hour. I ask that you keep these numbers in mind while I advance our arguments, Mr. Chair, for a discussion about something that's not in either one of the bills, but that we continue to hear about, and I see from the list of testifiers tonight that you are going to hear more about it. And that is a proposal to cap and freeze the wages of servers in Minnesota. Minnesota law, as you know, bars the practice of paying servers less than the minimum wage of $7.25 an hour because labor standards have been higher here since 1986. Surrounding states have no such prohibition. Wisconsin pays $2.13 an hour. Iowa, $4.35 an hour. North Dakota, $4.86 an hour, and South Dakota, $2.13 an hour. Restaurant owners you're going to hear from today who represent a very small percentage of the restaurants in Minnesota are going to tell you that waiters and waitresses make too much money. That if they get a raise in the minimum wage, it will artificially, I'm quoting here, put downward pressure on kitchen wages. An argument that gets recycled every year, you're going to hear it again tonight, but it's never supported by the facts. The notion is contradicted by wage data from surrounding states. For example, in Wisconsin, I told you what a waitress earns there, $2.33 an hour. Kitchen workers still earn less, a dollar less, than kitchen workers in Minnesota. Minnesota legislature should understand that the real artificial pressure is coming from a handful of well-heeled lobbyists hired to exploit their advantages, lower our expectations, and drop the higher standards that define our differences. And I'm talking about those surrounding states. Minnesotans value a workforce that is always at or near the top of every single measure of labor force excellence. Let's keep it that way. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Very well. Next on the list is Ben Gerber.
I'm going to let, we have a member that drove in too far. I'll give up that time.
We have time, but you can.
But I'll let him.
Go ahead. Please, would you take your seat, identify yourself for the record, and then proceed with your testimony.
I'm a little inexperienced in this, so this is the first time ever. So, Mr. Chair and...
it doesn't look like it, but we're somewhat friendly, actually.
My name's John Schmidt. I own a coffee shop in Waconia, Minnesota called Mocha Monkey. I took over in 2011, 3 years ago. In the last 2 months, I opened a second location, so we went from about 16 to 18 employees to 30 employees in the last 2 months. And I just wanted to bring the attention to the wide range of different people I have working for me and how I think this bill would really affect my business. I sat down yesterday to think about what would 950 actually do to my business. And it was fairly detrimental from what I saw, just based on the different types of people that I have working at my coffee shop. I have a lot of high school kids, a lot of kids that are in college, some out of college, and then some older as well. What we typically do is we pay $7.50 for a training wage, and then after that you get moved up to $8 right away, and then after that, depending on your experience, we go up from there. I have, out of my 30 employees, I have 13 that are making above $9.50 right now, and I would feel that those, and that's plus tips as well, so that's $9.50 plus $2 per hour. And I would say that those people are the people that are living off of that wage, that are using that to support their family, to help their families out. The other 17 that are being paid $9.50 or lower are not using that as a living wage. They're high school students. They are in college. They have other jobs. They're doing this job for fun. And those people are making between $8.50 and $9.50. And they're very happy, and they're making tips on top of that as well. And I feel like all my employees would really say that I care about them, and I do care about the employees. But if we were to pay those people all, we would have to pay, we'd be forced to pay about $1,400 more in payroll per month, which would equate to about $15,000 to $17,000 per year, which right now we don't really have that. So something would have to change in my business, whether it be those people that are making those living wages up above the $10 range, maybe that would have to come down. We would have to increase prices, which I don't know how much more people are going to pay for coffee that people already pay. So there's just some serious issues with this bill. I would say for me, the training wage or a youth wage are huge things that would help me, because we do have a lot of high schoolers, and that's a big part of our businesses to have those people. We have such a wide hours. We're 5 in the morning till 9 p.m., and so we have to fill all those hours. So that makes it tough to pay a lot of people, some people, a great living wage, which we're proud to do, but then also balance that out with some of the other ones as well. So in the interest of your time, that's all I have. I'd love to answer any questions you have.
Questions from members? No, thank you for coming.
Yeah.
And, okay, so next on the list we have Jeff Lindu. And you may correct me on the pronunciation of your last name. Yep, please proceed with the available mic.
Again, Chairs Winkler and Eaton, and members of the committee. Again, my name is Jeff Lindu. I am with Thrifty White Pharmacies, Vice President of Government and Regulatory Affairs with Thrifty White, and I am also the chair of the Legislative Committee for the Minnesota Retailers Association. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk today. A bit about our company. Thrifty White is a Minnesota-based company. We are an employee-owned company, an ESOP company. So the employees that work in our corporate office and in our stores are the owners of the company. And all of those employee owners would be impacted one way or another with the changes in minimum wage that you are discussing here today. Some may see an increase in wage. Certainly some are going to see a reduction in payroll hours as a if there is a significant increase in minimum wage. And as owners of the company, they will see any impact that a change like this has on the company. We don't employ a lot of individuals in the pay range that would be impacted directly by a minimum wage change. The one market that I looked at where we do employ a lot of individuals that are down in the seven something range is in Morris. And virtually every one of those individuals is a student at the college in Morris. I have been with Thrifty for 40 years. It's been a while since I worked as a manager of a store, but the minimum wage job is not, it is an entry level kind of position, certainly in our company. These are high school students, college students. These individuals, in many cases, it's their first job or close to the first job. They are learning basic job skills. In our organization, that is the purpose of a minimum wage job. The other part of it is we are working around their class schedules, their test schedules, their holiday schedules, and things like that. We do that because we can pay them a lower wage to work around those schedules and to train them in those basic job skills. A few more notes. Store payroll budget is a dollars budget. So any increase in wages automatically ends up in a reduction in work hours. That is simply the way payroll works in a retail business. Again, this is not, but we pay a lot of living wages within our company. The employees who come in at wages that are $9 and less are individuals in that kind of a training class. I would also like to point out that a training period for a person entering the job market is much longer than 90 days. Truly, it is a year, 2 years, 3 years for that individual to develop the job skills. I don't really know exactly what will happen to all of those student jobs in Morris if there is a substantial increase in minimum wage. I'm quite certain that there will be significantly fewer. I don't know if there will be any that will be working in our store. I would like to just touch on one other. We also, as we look at this, we need to consider our competitiveness with neighboring states. We own pharmacies in Fargo and we own pharmacies in Grand Forks. When I look at those communities, Fargo-Moorhead, Grand Forks, East Grand Forks, it is very apparent to me that we do not need one more reason for businesses to locate across the river in North Dakota in either of those. Those are the two border communities that we work in. We do not need another reason for businesses to locate across the river. We don't need another reason for customers to travel across the river and spend their shopping dollars in North Dakota. I'll close there and ask if there are any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lindu. I understand Senator Hayden has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lindu, I'm curious because I think this is a reoccurring theme that I've heard a lot. So you were saying, for instance, in your store in Morris, if the wage went up significantly, you don't think you'd be able to hire those college kids. So who would you hire, or would you close the store or not provide the service? I'm trying to understand.
Senator Hayden, are you finished with the question?
Okay.
Mr. Lindu.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, we would not close the store. Again, payroll is a function of, or the payroll budget is a function of dollars. I would say that if we have to pay substantially higher for an entrance wage, we are going to look in the community for individuals that already have job experience that don't have the class schedules and all of the things that we have to work around with a student, and somebody that has already had a previous job that has those basic work skills, because that's truthfully the trade-off with those individuals who are entering into the job market. We spend a fair amount of time working with those individuals, teaching them basic job skills.
So, Mr. Senator Chair, just a quick follow-up. So, Mr. Lindu, I'm trying to follow this. So, essentially, you are saying that the store that you have in Morris is really set up to help young people who are in college learn great job skills, and that's why you hire them, not because they're good and productive employees that produce the service that you do in that community. I mean, that sounds like that's what you're saying to me, and I just want to be sure that's what you're saying.
Mr. Lindu.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden. It's a relatively small segment of our employees in Morris. We certainly have many other employees that are well above those salary ranges. We fill some of our positions with those students because we can pay a lower, close to minimum wage salary with those individuals as a trade-off for the things that we do. So those jobs would be filled with different individuals who are not new entrants to the job market.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Eden.
Thank you. Could you give me an idea of approximately how much of your budget is payroll?
Mr. Lindu.
I'm not a business person, so I'm just trying to...
I'm not real familiar with those numbers. I think something in the range of $10 plus or 10% plus minus of sales. I think that varies substantially by margins on the product one is selling, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing.
Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We are going to reverse a couple of folks around. We just found out that Centauri, I'm going to really blow this last name, Devant, Sylvia Martinez, and Maricela Flores are needing to leave, and so we're going to call them up next, and then we'll switch that spot with Alex Fitzsimmons. So if Centauri, Sylvia, or Maricela are here, we would ask them to come down. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Kanta Ray Devant.
Please proceed.
Okay, so I'm going to kind of go off of the last person who spoke. I obviously am a minimum wage worker at Walmart. I'm a college graduate. I have a 4-year degree, and I love my education. I wouldn't trade it for the world. But going back to work was a necessity for me, given my situation. I don't have a safety net. I can't travel to find a job in my field. So in order for me to be able to continue a livable lifestyle, I need to be able to live a living wage. I need to be able to, you know, see that $9.50 isn't really a livable wage, but it's better than what I have now. And the other thing, too, is if we don't raise the wage, we're losing well-trained, educated workers to go to another state or to halfway across the country where they are able to find good paying jobs so that they can live off of a livable wage. So not that I disagree with what has been said so far, but for me, living off of $9.50 would be a start towards being able to lift myself up, being able to relocate to find a job in my field. And I'm asking, because Walmart won't pay its workers a living wage, that senators that I have elected to represent me will do the right thing and represent the people they have elected. So I'm holding them accountable, since I can't hold Walmart accountable to do the right thing. That's all I really have to say right now. Any questions?
Thank you. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Kandari?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you for your testimony. I have a question about what your major was in college, and a more personal question about if you are carrying any debt from that college education.
Ms. Kandari.
Okay. So first off, my major was International Studies with a minor in Political Science. Both degrees are basically geared towards nation development, and basically going through a lot of what we're going through right now, trying to make sure that we are able to fix the economy. And I do have student loan debt that I cannot currently afford to pay. I have fallen behind of that due to the fact that I recently lost my full-time paying job on top of working for Walmart part-time due to Minnesota winter weather. So I do have a lot of debt that I'm trying to keep up with, and I can't right now.
Any further questions from the committee? Representative Metza.
To that point, Mr. Chair, thank you. Would you say that if you do not find a job soon, that it would be something that could damage your credit score and maybe put you in a position that makes it even harder over a short period of time to crawl out of the hole?
Currently, it already has. I'm approaching default on one of my loans because I've been busy trying to find a job so I can at least pay the bills I currently have to put food on my table. Relocating is essential for me right now, and it's not like I haven't reconsidered, you know, leaving the state to go elsewhere.
Thank you. That's it.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Sylvia Martinez. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Buenas tardes, mi nombre es Silvia Martinez.
So, good afternoon, my name is Silvia Martinez, and also my name is Ruth Schultz, I'll be the interpreter.
Thank you.
Yo he trabajado en Savers por 7 años, entré ganando de a 6.50.
So, I've worked at Savers for 7 years, and I started making $6.50 an hour.
Nunca logré ganar de a $8. Los aumentos eran de 10 o 15 centavos cada 3 años.
I didn't even get to making $8 an hour. You know, every 3 years there's a 15 cent raise or a 30 cent raise.
Nunca logré tener un ahorro para una emergencia, para cualquier cosa que yo pudiera necesitar. Solo lo que yo ganaba era solo para mi renta, mis biles y la comida y los gastos que yo podía y
what I was able to earn was just living day by day to pay for food, to pay for bills, to pay for rent. I was never able to save anything for any type of emergency or anything coming in the future.
Estoy apoyando el aumento de sueldo de 9.50 para que las familias tengamos una mejor calidad de vida.
So I'm here in support of the proposal to raise the minimum wage to $9.50 so that families can have a better quality of life.
Y también que tengamos una mejor calidad dentro de la sociedad.
And also for a better society.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Can we ask a research question?
Representative Metza, if you want to be recognized, I will recognize you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for research, and it doesn't need an answer now, but overall, do you think that the cost of living has gone up more than 15 cents an hour? in the last few years, or every 3 years, does it go up more than 15 cents an hour?
Representative Metza, I will intervene on behalf of House Research and ask not to answer sort of an editorial question, and I'll answer for you, yes. Any further questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Next on the list is Maricela Flores. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Hola, buenas tardes. Mi nombre es Maricela Flores.
So, good afternoon. My name is Maricela Flores.
Trabajo en la limpieza para Carson Limpiando Target en Chacope, Minnesota.
I work cleaning for Carlson Building Maintenance, cleaning a Target in Shakopee, Minnesota.
Yo estoy apoyando el sueldo mínimo porque hemos estado luchando por tres años para que nos aumenten el salario. Yo gano a $8 la hora tratando de sobrevivir a cuatro hijos.
So I'm here supporting to raise the minimum wage to $9.50 for 3 years. You know, I've been working with my coworkers to try and win raises, but I'm a single mother. I have four kids and I make $8 an hour.
Tengo que trabajar dos trabajos y no pongo suficiente atención hacia los hijos, y yo digo, mi opinión es que si subieran el sueldo mínimo ayudaríamos un poco a nuestros hijos también y a darles un poco más de atención a los que tenemos hijos.
So I, for making such a low wage, I have to work two jobs and I'm not able to give as much attention as I'd like to my kids. And I'd like to say if we raise the minimum wage, it would enable parents to be able to give more attention, the attention that our kids need.
Yo apoyo el sueldo mínimo porque digo, si está subiendo la carne y están subiendo las cosas materiales, yo digo que tienen que subir a un nivel para que balancemos el nivel de ingreso.
I also support raising the minimum wage with the cost of living. If the price of meat is going up, if the price of vegetables, if the price of food is going up, I think that the minimum wage should also go up.
Pues es todo lo que tengo que decirles.
So that's everything that I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Question from members? Okay, thank you very much. Next on the list, we'll go to Bruce Nelson from ARM. And Alexander Fitzsimmons, I'm going to slot you in where these three testifiers were going to be. Mr. Nelson, you know the drill.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Conference Committee. I'm Bruce Nelson with ARM. ARM is an association of disability providers across the state of Minnesota. Many of you have visited some of our members' group homes. It's one example of what we do. The proposal before you creates a moral conundrum for many of us, for all of us at ARM, is we believe that when people who show up to work ought to be paid a living wage so they can support their families. But it does get complicated in our world. Among our members in ARM, there are about 150 of them, the only people who are paid a minimum wage are those people who sleep at night in a group home. And they're paid, you know, during the hours they sleep, typically minimum wage. If they wake up, they get paid a direct support wage. Now, where it gets complicated is 97% of our revenue comes from government, principally medical assistance or Medicaid. And out of that, 79% of expenditure goes to staff wages, typically caregivers across the state of Minnesota, many thousands of them. And as you know, there has been a rate stagnation, if you will, over the past several years. And caregivers who are working during the daytime, often with many jobs, haven't seen an increase in 5 years. So the effect of this is, because almost all the money comes from government, in order to pay people who are sleeping a minimum wage, you'd be robbing from Peter, who is doing the work during the day, to pay Paul to sleep. And that's where it gets complicated. The bill before you addresses this issue in two ways. The Senate bill on line 2.7 basically keeps the minimum wage at the federal level, assuming that could go to 10-10. We don't know where that's going to go, but it keeps it at the federal level for people while they're asleep. The House bill on line 2.29 talks about actually paying for the minimum wage increase for people in our area who are paid to sleep. We are now working with Representative Huntley and his fiscal staff to try to cost that out for you, what that would cost pay for that, for this component in the House bill. As I understand it, there is not at this point a fiscal note attached to that. I want to say one final thing. I trust you're aware that there is a proposal, bills introduced today, many of them, calling for a 5% rate increase out of the 5% campaign. And in our minds, and the thousands of caregivers who have been talking to you the last few months, that money is for catch-up for their wages. It's catch-up for maintaining a home and the overhead and the fixed costs that go with that. It is not in our mind, and I hope in yours, not to pay for an increase in the minimum wage. Therefore, I implore you as you move forward with your good work and doing your best to make sure that people, when they show up for work, get a living wage to support their families, find a way to pay for, as we're asking business to do, pay for the minimum wage increase. And in our area, that's people who are paid to sleep. So thank you very much. And with that, I'm open to questions.
Questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Nelson.
Thank you.
Next on the list is Linnea House.
Good evening, Representative Winkler, Senator Eaton, and the members of the committee. It's my honor to be here today. My name is Linnea House. I'm the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota, a 50,000-member strong nonprofit organization committed to protecting women's reproductive rights, including the right to bear and support healthy children right here in Minnesota. I am here to testify in support of raising the minimum wage in Minnesota. At all levels of our public policy work, NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota supports policies and programs that allow women to make the reproductive health choices that are best for them and their families. We believe that the current minimum wage does not allow women and their families the resources they need to make their optimal reproductive health choices. A core part of our mission is to ensure that all families have the ability to bear and support their healthy children. And as women continue to remain clustered around low-paying positions, about 63% of low-income earners are women, this continues to be a struggle for many parents and families. As the number of working mothers are increasingly the primary wage earners in their households in Minnesota, this modest increase in the minimum wage and indexing it to inflation will give more families the tools needed to support their families. As you likely already know, currently in Minnesota, 40% of white mothers, 47% of Asian American mothers, 60% of Latina mothers, 77% of African mothers, and 80% of American Indian mothers are the primary wage earner. And while it must be noted that not all of these women currently earn the minimum wage, an increase in the minimum wage will serve as a lifeline for many of these families. Finally, in addition to supporting raising the minimum wage, we also wholeheartedly support the 12 weeks parental leave for birth and adoption provision, as it is critical support for all parents, both moms and dads, to be with their children during the first weeks of their lives with the family. Thank you for your time.
Questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony, Ms. House. Next on the list is the Reverend Elliot Howard. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes, with your testimony. Reverend Elliot Howard, pastor of Linden Hills United Church of Christ in Minneapolis. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak in favor of raising the minimum wage in Minnesota. As a small congregation in Minneapolis, we meet many people in our ministry, people who come to our worship service, whose lives would be greatly enhanced by an increase in the minimum wage. I want to speak specifically about a young man who's been in our congregation, unable to be here today because he's working, but working in a minimum wage job. I've known him for 3 years. Over 3 years, we have time to time helped him with basic necessities of food and other basic items for his daughter. About 18 months ago, his wife suffered a severe incident of mental illness, has not recovered from that, and is no longer able to be alone with their child. Child is 2 years old. The man of whom I'm speaking, the dad, is 22 now years old. I think we hear a lot about people that age and how they are perhaps working some, not supporting the family. This young man is the support for his daughter, the only support in the family. He needs to struggle to go to his $7.80 hour job. He also needs to scramble and visit us and other places to find the necessities to pull things together for his daughter. So I'm speaking on his behalf and behalf of others, a dad who is basically a single dad, trying to get by. We are happy at the church to try and help him out with things. We know him well enough and know his tenacity and courage sufficiently that sometimes when we aren't able to help him out, we will reach out to him and tell him we have resources, a few dollars to help right now. Come by. He comes by bus. He comes by bicycle to receive $20 to buy diapers to care for his daughter. So that is basically the story I want to tell. There are many others. I appreciate your time and would entertain any questions.
Seeing no questions, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you all.
Next on the list is Ken Rockler. Mr. Rockler, I seem to be spending quite a few evenings with you.
That's your magnetic personality.
Please proceed.
Chairman Winkler, members of the committee, Ken Rockler here, and I represent the Tavern League of Minnesota and the Bowling Proprietors Association, and I usually manage to get hate phone calls from both sides after I get done testifying. I do not oppose the raise in the minimum wage. I've made this comment before that in the metropolitan area, I can't speak to when you get out into the further areas of exurbia and the rural areas, whether it would work or not, but I was quoted last year and I've been in articles on it. I'm not sure how somebody can live on $10 an hour. So I'll get some hate calls from some of my fellow lobbyists up there. Full disclosure, I'm not one of those highly paid lobbyists that was discussed before. I'm probably the lowest paid lobbyist of all. There are many compelling reasons to support a tip credit, as evidenced by the fact that 80% of all states with a combined population in excess of 250 million people and represented by over 6,500 legislators that understand the importance of tip credit to jobs, a state's economy, and the hospitality industry. There are only 7 states that do not have tip credit, and they're only represented by slightly over 900 legislators. I need to clarify something. The tip credit as proposed last year, actually I think it's dual wage, two-tiered wage, it does not cap a server's wage at $12. That's totally erroneous. A server that's making $27 an hour right now would be making $27 an hour then. What it was is, it's a guarantee to make sure that the tip credit could not be applied unless somebody is making $12 an hour. Tip credit makes it easier and more likely for restaurants to give raises to the lowest paid non-tipped workers in the hospitality industry. It keeps restaurant prices lower, which is part of the reason why it actually ends up helping servers if we could get it. They're being driven away right now from the full service establishments where they're making anywhere from $18 to $35 an hour. They're being driven to places like Chipotle, Panera Bread, D'Amico and Sons, fast food establishments, where there's very little tipping, and in some cases it's not even allowed, and you're certainly not allowed to charge on a credit card. I don't really have a lot of faith in the border issue. I know some people argue it as far as the restaurant business. I don't think too many people make their decision on whether they're going to a restaurant in Fargo versus Moorhead because of the tip credit, but I do know that the restaurants build in Fargo rather than Moorhead because of that. Moorhead was looking for an exclusion last year, but they were advised not to, to go there. I think it's important to get the facts clear on this because there's a lot of numbers that get thrown around. Tipped employees in Minnesota, those that come under the Tip Reporting Determination Act, average between $16 and $25 and up per hour. This isn't a pie-in-the-sky figure. It can be documented by looking at the reports these establishments have to file with the IRS, comparing gross sales to charge sales, and then gross declared tips to charge tips. Federal law requires that a minimum of 8% of gross sales be declared as tips. If that number isn't reached, the management must allocate tips. Employees have the right to appeal if they don't make that percentage. However, no one that I know in the business, or for that matter, no one that I know, period, is aware of any server that has appealed that they actually did not make 8% of gross sales. This law has been in effect since 1991. If either the House or Senate version or a compromise passes without tip credit or two-tiered wage, in over 95% of the restaurants with tipped employees, the only people to get a raise will be the tipped employees who earn double, triple, and more than the cooks, dishwashers, and prep cooks. Another threat, and there's a reason why it's happening right now, if you've been out to Concourse G, they're no longer having waitresses in some areas, they're using iPads. That's true at LaGuardia, and I've been told that Chili's, I believe, is starting to do that right now at the moment. Lack of a tip credit is one of the main reasons we're driving customers from highly paid tip positions to fast food and fast casual. My closing statement is that if anybody has any doubt as to the veracity of these statements, I pose the following question and challenge. Please name one of the thousands of restaurants in the metro area where the tipped employees make less than $14 an hour. Just name one, anybody, for that matter, anybody in the audience. There is no such animal. I've heard the argument that, well, people are switching already to iPads, so it's inevitable. Well, death is inevitable also, but we're not all going to go out and shoot ourselves tomorrow. I think that the jobs that are being lost and will be continue to be lost without a tip credit are a very serious issue. Thank you for allowing me to appear before you today. I opened any questions anybody might have or comments.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to comment on one thing. I actually had an interesting exchange at the chamber dinner the other night with some of our friends from the north, the Consulate General up in, I believe it was Manitoba, and we just haven't seen the influx of jobs running to International Falls, and their minimum wage is at $10 or $11, so I just wanted to point that out to the group.
Thank you, Representative Metzl. I don't think that's to Mr. Rockler. Any further committee questions? Thank you, Mr. Rockler, for your testimony. Mr. Jennings, I have you next. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
First of all, committee, I want to thank you and Representative Winkler for giving me the opportunity to speak today. My name is Mike Jennings, and I'm here partially on my own behalf. My father and my sister and I have three restaurants in the western suburbs, and I'm also a board member for the Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association, so I'm also speaking on their behalf. You know, when I look at a bill, one of the things I wanted to make sure is that it was fair and balanced. And in considering that, I look at the three different groups of people that are involved in this. Number one is obviously the employees. Number two are the customers. Number three are the owners. And my three places to start out with, just to give an idea of foundation of where I'm coming from, is this increase is going to cost us roughly $60,000 to $70,000 per year per location. So it's pretty substantial. In talking to other members, it pretty much is averaged somewhere between $35,000 to over $100,000 a year. And with this gentleman over here with the coffee shop, he's smaller, $15,000 a year. So with an increase of this magnitude, the question is, can we really just absorb this? And I think, obviously, with the cost of increase in food costs on all of our utilities, property taxes, and so forth, to simply absorb this is really not an option. So menu prices are going to have to go up. How much? That'll be, it's really tough to say at this point, but all I can say is that just the other day I went on the internet and I pulled up the local Applebee's here, and cost of cowboy burger was $9.59 an hour, and I just randomly pulled up a Applebee's in Oregon where minimum wage is in the mid 950 range, and that same burger was $10.99 an hour per entree. So we're looking at, you know, basically $1.40 increase just for a burger. And so I look at that, and one of the things I look at is that, you know, I understand that there will be some type of minimum wage increase, but what concerns me is that servers are having a great opportunity to make a lot more money, and contrary to what's been said before, that it will not impact your hosts and your non-tipped employees like cooks and so forth. I've been through this. I've been in this business myself for 24 years. I've been through a handful of minimum wage increases. And the fact is this, is that there's just not enough money to go around to take care of your cooks and all your other non-tipped employees. So, you know, what seems to be fair for the one group of employees, as we talk about that, is it really, it's fair for some people because they're going to get a raise, but it's not fair for the other half. So it's really not, it's not fair for employees. I look at my customers. Should they really be paying a dollar or more per entree? I think that's really a lot. And then I look at employers, and we're the ones that are going to try to figure out how to balance this thing out and try to figure out how to keep people from coming into our places. We've had testimony from people that clearly make just the minimum wage. We haven't heard from anyone who's tipped at all, but Representative Winkler, I know I'm going to mess up the statistic that you and I talked about earlier, that 40% of employees in the state make $14 an hour or less. Did I do that right?
40% of jobs in Minnesota pay less than $14 an hour.
Okay, thank you.
Quite a few of those people probably have more than one of those jobs.
Sure, absolutely. And here's the thing is we got these 40% of people. It just doesn't seem right that we're going to give a wage increase to servers and bartenders and expect these people, at least this 40%, who are making half as much as they are, to subsidize their pay raise. That doesn't make one bit of sense to me, and I think that's something that really needs to be considered. And because, you know, a fair and balanced bill is one that's good for customers, for employees, and employers, and I just don't see the balance here.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony, Mr. Jennings. I understand that Rachel English has a time limit, so I would ask her to come forward. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Rachel English, and I'm here representing Jewish Community Action. So Judaism values work, and it values the worker. The former Sephardic chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, Chaim David Halevi, explained it this way. In the Jewish worldview, work is sacred. It is building and creating, and it is a partnership with God in the work of creation. Given that context, you might imagine that Judaism also believes that the ones who do this sacred work, and here, let me say I'm not talking about a particular type of work, but any type of work, You might imagine that Judaism also believes that the workers who do this are deserving of dignity and respect, and of course you would be right. Do not oppress the hired laborer who is poor and needy, whether he is one of your people or one of the sojourners in your land. It's so powerful. Do not oppress the hired laborer who is poor and needy, whether he is one of your people or one of the sojourners in your land. That's Deuteronomy. For the text goes on to say that his life depends on those wages. And in Minnesota, as you all know, we have at least 360,000 low-wage workers whose lives depend on those wages. Minimum wage right now amounts to little more than $15,000 a year for a single person. That's barely above the poverty line. For a family, it's well below it. In 2008, the conservative movement, the largest denomination in Judaism, approved a resolution on work and workers, urging employers to pay their employees a living wage. $9.50 an hour, indexed to inflation, which amounts to a little bit less than $20,000 a year, is not quite a living wage. But for those 360,000 Minnesotans whose lives depend on low-wage work, those 360,000 people that the Torah tells us clear as day not to oppress, the difference between $7.25 on one hand and $9.50 indexed to inflation with a 40-hour work week and family leave on the other is a difference between oppression on one hand and dignity and respect on the other. So I will just leave you with this last thought. In summing up the Jewish tradition on work and workers, Rabbi Halevi says, "The sages of Israel and their courts always knew to side with the worker." Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from members? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. I also understand that Kristen Cece, and I'm sorry if I have the last name wrong, has a time limitation, so please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and proceed.
Hi, I am Kristen Cece. I own three small businesses in Minnesota, a dog daycare and boarding facility, an event rental business, and a Spanish immersion preschool and daycare. I wanted to come today because having been a Democrat and been heavily involved in campaigns for my entire life, I fundamentally support paying workers, you know, a fair wage. But I can say that as a small business owner as well, that this would have a huge impact on us. I know, for example, for our dog daycare, my business partner and I calculated what this would cost us, and in 1 year it would cost us about $25,000. Now, because our business makes, our gross sales this year was $550,000, so we are right above this new limit. But that's our gross sales. It doesn't take into account the net profit. So basically, this will directly cut into either us being able to pay ourselves, and I'm not, I guess, like a target executive. You know, I don't have millions of dollars that I'm making. So it could be the difference between us having a fair salary, you know, something that's even equivalent to someone making, you know, a normal, like a teacher's salary, versus not being able to pay us much at all. This would directly affect our customers, because if there was an increase, which there obviously will be, we will have to increase prices. I can tell you that we wouldn't lose jobs. I mean, we're not going to let go of people. We have to have workers at our facility. I can also say that at all of my businesses, I don't pay any workers minimum wage. The lowest paying jobs are at the dog daycare facility. It starts at $8 an hour, and within 6 months, all workers receive a raise. That raise is dependent on their qualifications, how well they've done over those previous 6 months, and from there it goes up. Now, I'm not opposed to a minimum wage increase. I am opposed to an increase to $9.50. I feel like that is a very significant increase for us. And I guess I'm in support of an increase to something like $8 an hour indexed to inflation, because I agree that indexing it to inflation is an appropriate step to take, because the cost of everything does increase. And so I guess I just wanted to come and share some input about how it would affect us as small businesses. So.
Thank you. Questions from members? Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if this is an answer or a question for the witness or maybe for staff, but so how does the change in the bill of the definition of a small employer from 500,000 or 625,000 to 500,000 affects somebody like Ms. Chichi here. CC, sorry. In Italian, we just say Chichi.
It's my understanding that the testimony was about $550,000 in gross sales. So, Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomassoni, federal law has a current threshold of $500,000. And you're subject to the minimum wage, or if you have deal in interstate commerce. Consequently, there are very few businesses, regardless of size, that are not subject to federal law because of the interstate commerce part of it. So, and not knowing a lot of information, but that the House bill would drop the threshold from 625,000 of business activity to 500,000.
And so, Mr.
Senator Tomassoni,
Ms. Newman, so if she's has credit card business, for example, would that be something that would be considered interstate commerce?
Mr. Chair, based on my conversations with the Department of Labor and Industry Labor Standards folks, that credit card activity, there is an interstate commerce trigger.
Senator Thomas.
And Mr. Chairman, Ms. Cece, do you know that?
Do Ms. I know Cece? That if we accept, are you saying if we accept credit cards? I mean, well, I guess I'm not sure what.
Do you know that as a result of the potential for interstate commerce determinations that your business might have a different threshold as far as where the small business line affects you?
No, I'm not aware of that. I can say that ultimately, whether it's 500 or 625,000, it really doesn't have a big difference because it's based on gross proceeds. So we could spend, like this year, we moved to a new building. So our net profit was like $10,000. So it was very little because we had a lot of expenses in moving to a new building. If it was based on gross profits, that'd be a different story, because then if you have gross profits of $500,000, then of course you should be subject to, if you have that much net income, then of course you should be subject to something. But when your net profit is so little and you make gross, your gross sales are so high, you basically have to pull that from somewhere. I mean, I can say that if this increase had happened this year, we would have been in the negative versus a very small positive.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Further questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
There's another, that was those three. There's another individual who had a time restriction on testimony, and that was Mr. Schwartzman. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Danny Schwartzman, and I own Common Roots Cafe and Common Roots Catering in Minneapolis, and I'm happy to be testifying today. I'm here to support the increase in the wage. I've been happy since we opened and felt very strongly since we opened in 2007 that it's important to pay workers a decent wage. So since day one, we've paid in excess of $11 an hour. Not just the commitment that we've made, because I think it's the right thing to do, and I think it's the right thing to do to have employees not depend on the generosity of customers to receive a decent wage. So that's a baseline wage we pay regardless of tips or not, and that's for all workers, front of house and back of house. There's certainly challenges to doing that. That certainly on the surface means we have higher labor costs, and it's expensive and challenging, and as others have testified, as small business owners, costs are always going up. There's lots of expenses. And we deal with increases all the time. For me, I don't understand why we draw a line at labor as being the cost that can't go up. Everything else goes up. And I believe that workers who work for us should receive a wage that they can go home and hopefully pay the bills with. So that's just a baseline expectation. Since when we opened in 2007, we had 15 full-time equivalent workers. Since then, we have grown our business. We've launched a catering business that's now a standalone business as well that has the same wage standards. In the last year, we had 50 full-time equivalents working for us. We've done that growth in jobs with these wage standards that exceed the levels that we're talking about here. And so it's certainly something that I think is possible. Is it challenging? Of course it's challenging. But as small business owners, we do things that are challenging all the time. And I would certainly look forward to seeing more workplaces have to pay these kinds of wages. Because I think they'll see, as I do over time, that it yields in a lot of different ways. While the bottom line initially might see increased labor costs, we've seen much lower turnover in jobs. Our staff is happier, and they are more experienced. We get better customer service out of it. And I know that I feel confident that we're doing the right thing, which I think is the most valuable part. So I'm happy to support this increase. I would actually support a larger increase. And I thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk to you all. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions from the committee. Senator Hayden.
I'm sorry. Tell me your name again. I'm sorry.
It's Danny Schwartzman.
Danny Schwartzman. I like your coffee shop. I go there frequently.
Thank you.
So I just wanted to get that plug in just across the street from my district. I do have a question, Mr. Schwartzman. Have you been able to quantify the cost of turnover in your establishment? So in other words, how much does it cost you? How much does it cost when someone leaves and you have to hire someone new?
You know, we haven't quantified it directly. I don't have a number for you. But obviously there's at least a month of training for most employees. Some of them are much longer than that. We have delays in getting people trained in and going as well. So there's certainly significant costs. I think the biggest cost is just in the quality of service. It takes a number of months before someone is able to fully step up and be a full-speed staff person who can also... and the more people know about our business, the better they're able to serve customers. So that it's not a clear line on a budget. But the yield of people who are there longer means that they know what they're doing. They are familiar with what we're doing. They know our customers better. And hopefully we have more customers because of it. But I don't have a dollar number for you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. No, that's good.
Any further questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
The last person I have who asked to move up was Nancy Maker.
Mr. Chair, Conference Committee, my name is Nancy Maker, and I'm Executive Director of A Minnesota Without Poverty, a statewide movement to end poverty in Minnesota by 2020. In 2006, a bill to create a bipartisan commission to end poverty in Minnesota by 2020 was formed. It was passed with bipartisan support. In 2009, this bipartisan legislative commission gave their recommendations. The first recommendation on their list of six was to restore work as a means out of poverty. And under that, the very first key issue that they recommended was to ensure that work pays and to increase the minimum wage to $9.50. That was 5 years ago. We have been waiting 5 years for this moment. Last spring, when we were trying to decide what we should do, we decided to use the phrase ketchup to the cost of living. We took a ketchup bottle and put the label on it, ketchup to the cost of living, raised the minimum wage to $9.50, and on the back we put on minimum wage earner facts. Who are the people making minimum wage in Minnesota? That ketchup bottle was taken to every senator. Some of you senators may have one sitting in your office right now. I don't know. But we took it to every senator. Last spring, or in August then, I was buying 34 more of these bottles to take to the state fair, and I was going through the checkout line. And the woman at the checkout line, her curiosity said, "Why are you buying these ketchup bottles? Do you run a summer camp or something like that?" And I said, "No, we are doing this as an advocacy effort to raise the minimum wage to $9.50." And she said, "If you can do that, you will be my friend for life." And then she proceeded to tell me that she's been working three jobs, and she had just actually quit that third job because she never got to see her two children. So she said, if they would raise the minimum wage to $9.50, would it happen immediately? Would it happen overnight? Because that would mean that I could quit one of my jobs. So my request to you is go ahead, catch up to the cost of living, at least part way, and then let's keep it up. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Seeing none, we will move on to, I was wrong, I said that we were through the folks who asked to move up, but I understand that Steve Summers and Max Mattis have time constraints, so I would like to call Mr. Summers first. Or maybe they can come together. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
I said, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Steve Summers. I work for Jerry's Foods in the Twin Cities. We have 20 supermarkets with different formats. We operate 14 Cub Food stores in the Twin Cities, and then we also operate county markets in the outlying areas in North Branch, Minnesota, and then we have stores in Elk River and Rogers as well. We employ 3,200 people in our company, and approximately 70% of them are part-time. 20% of those part-time people would be directly affected by the minimum wage raise. We have numbers of people that are well over the minimum wage that are also part-time. Their positions are typically entry-level with high school kids, college kids, some special needs kids, and oftentimes many of them stay with us through high school and college and even make a career out of it and continue to move up the wage rate as they stay with us for a longer period of time and acquire some experience. With an increase at the lower level, there's also a compression effect where every other level of pay will continue to have to be raised as the less experienced people in our organization come up to the level of the more experienced people. So it will continue all the way up the ladder, and this will result in the plain and simple fact that we will have to raise prices. We have a number of stores in our organization that have very razor-thin margins, barely making a dollar, or even loss situations as well. So as this goes by and we continue to have to do this, we would definitely have to look at layoffs and reducing our workforce or figuring out a way to cut costs. Labor is our highest expense in the business, and this would be devastating to us at this time. Any questions?
Seeing none, I guess we will move on to Mr. Mattis.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Max Mattis. I'm a store director for Kowalski's Markets, a local business started in 1983 on Grand Avenue and since has grown to this date to 9 stores spanning across Minneapolis and St. Paul. We have roughly 1,200 employees. We have 83, I personally, within my store, I personally supervise 83 employees with an average hourly rate of $14.21. 61 of those employees have full retirement and health benefits. The tenure of those employees, I have 21 and less with 1 year of service, 8 at 1 to 2 years of service, 10 at 2 to 3, 23 at 3 to 10 years of service, and 21 at over 10 years of service. Within my store. A lot of similar challenges to the wage increase to the $9.50 an hour. That would make a third of our employees as a company. Bringing that number to $9.50 an hour would result in a 1.3% payroll increase for us over the course of 1 year, or for roughly $400,000 in additional payroll expense just over the course of a single year. And I know just a side note is information given from Jamie Poole from the Minnesota Grocers Association. I know the a question was raised to the Common Roots gentleman about the average cost of a single instance of turnover, roughly costs the business $5,000. It's just an industry standard that from Jamie Poole and the Minnesota Grocers Association. In closing, I mean, I'm certainly in alignment with Jerry's organization that the minimum wage should not be raised to $9.50.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Matt Schreiber.
Hello, my name is Matt Schreiber, and I'm representing MPIRB. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I am a senior at Augsburg College from Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and I'm from Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and a member of Minnesota Public Interest Research Group, better known as MPIRG. MPIRG is a grassroots, nonpartisan, student-directed nonprofit that empowers and trains students and engages the community to take collective action in the public interest throughout the state of Minnesota. Throughout the debate on raising the minimum wage, young people and college students have, at times, served as scapegoats for those who believe current poverty wages are sufficient. They point to the young people, person working at McDonald's, and say they don't deserve higher wages because they are just working for fun and don't need the money. We believe that this is extremely short-sighted and sends a message that their work is less than others, is worth less than others. With the skyrocketing cost of higher education, many college students work minimum wage jobs just to make a small impact on the debt they graduate with. A student taking on an average course load is told by a higher education institution that they should spend 60 hours per week on their studies. Add on a 20-hour part-time work week at minimum wage, and these students can work 80 hours a week for a semester and still not make enough to pay for rent while they're in school, not to mention tuition and books. But this situation is even more dire for those students and young people who have families to support on top of everything else. These students are present at all colleges and universities and have an especially strong presence at Augsburg College, I'm proud to say, which caters to many non-traditional students. There are others that will testify today whose needs are more immediate and who will offer more compelling reasons for Minnesota to stop raising the minimum wage. But raising our minimum wage to $9.50 will do more than just help families right now. It will help the high schooler who is just trying to put away enough money to make college education a financially viable option for them. It will help the college student working 3 part-time jobs on top of their studies graduate with a less debt and little more prepared to contribute to our state's economic growth. It will help the single parent who's trying to secure better future for their children by going back to school so they can try to raise a family on more than minimum wage. And maybe most importantly to this committee, it will help our economy by freeing up all minimum wage workers to spend more in communities all across our great state. MPIRG strongly encourages the committee to help move our state out of the business of paying poverty wages by passing an increase of minimum wage to $9.50 an hour. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Representative Metza.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was wondering, do you think it might help if we index this to school tuition?
Mr. Schreiber.
I'm open for suggestions. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Next on the list is Sam Leon, or Leon, depending on how you might want to pronounce it. It looks like if you're also joining in, please just sit down together and we'll...
We're just both independent restaurant owners.
Yep, please come forward. And either one of you can start and just identify yourself for the record and start with your testimony.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sam Leone, and I'm with Acapulco Restaurants, and thank you for the opportunity today for letting us testify. So my family, my eight brothers and sisters, and my parents, and of course myself, we decided to move to Minnesota and open up a restaurant here 20 years ago. Since then, our restaurants have flourished to eight restaurants, we have also decided to open an Irish pub. And of course, only in America can an immigrant family from Mexico open up an Irish pub. So we're pretty grateful to live in America for that. So at this point, we employ about 516 wonderful employees, and including that, 242, which are tip server employees and bartenders as well. My parents migrated from Mexico about 42 years ago in search of the American dream, and working hard, and they taught us to work very hard. They started working in sweatshops in Los Angeles, and they did work the less than minimum per hour jobs, and they were able to save all their money, and since then they've opened up 9 restaurants. You could do it in America. In respects to minimum wage, if a significant increase to the minimum wage is passed without recognition of tips, restaurants are going to have to do the following, or at least we will. So at Acapulco, we're going to look at reducing staff hours, unfortunately, increasing menu prices, because there's no way we can sustain this, and looking ways to replace some labor. We are talking to different companies out there who have that, those little iPads where you order, and that's one of the last things I want to do, because that takes away from the whole experience. So I'm not a big fan of that, but if I'm forced to do it, and I have no choice, I might have to do that. So this minimum wage legislation could hurt the very people this minimum wage increase is supposed to help. And for our company, our fiscal impact, company-wide, we're looking at a $565,881 with a proposed $950 an hour. This impact compounded along with the Affordable Care Act, it's also looming, will be a combined increase operating cost at $915,000. Now, who has $1 million just laying around to cover all these costs? We don't. I lay at night wondering, how am I going to do this? Am I going to price myself out of a restaurant? And so it's scary. I'm losing a lot of sleep over this, and I'm trying to figure out how am I going to do this. We simply do not have that kind of money. My tipped employees currently make an average of $23 an hour with tips. So if you require restaurants to give raises to servers already making more than minimum wage, it makes more difficult for us to give back-of-the-house employees the proper raises they deserve. We also respectfully ask that you consider the following points. So the overall rate needs to be reasonable. We recognize that there will be an increase, but keep in mind that all of our border states are paying less than what we're going to be paying. And of course, the indexing the rate to inflation, I'm not sure about that idea. Something this important should not be on autopilot, and states that have indexed, like Oregon and Washington, haven't seen too good of results. If raises do happen, please, my ask is to let's phase it in 3 to 4 years. Let's not do it all in one punch, because it's going to be a big blow for us. We strongly support including a youth wage and training wage to help give young people a start. And I guess I just want to thank you for your consideration, and please help us in keeping our doors open.
Thank you. Mr. Fong, please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, the members of the committee, my name is Ed Fong. I'm the owner of David Fong's restaurant in Bloomington. I'm an independent restaurant. We've been in business for over 50 years. My parents started out in 1958 with a 600 square foot carryout, and now we've opened a full service restaurant. We employ about 60 employees. 18 of them are tip employees. I can certainly repeat a lot of things that Sam has said. Being an independent restaurant, we really don't have the opportunity to cost average expenses over multiple locations. The increase would just be just too fast, too much at one time. We need to phase this all in. It also affects other things like insurance, taxes,
all the other things that we have to also put in the equation of what kind of increases. I don't know if Sam put that into that increase, but I would add that to my to the numbers that, that he has that we have to face also. Again, as an independent restaurant, we don't have the resources to do some of a lot of things that maybe large chains do and stuff like that. But out of those 60 employees, over half of them have been with me over 10 years, some with two of them 40 years. So I think I treat my employees very well. I hope they treat them very well. They treat me very well. They treat my customers very well. And I want to keep that tradition going on with our family. Being second generation, it's very important to me. My parents are very proud of the business they started, and I want to continue that tradition. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Metza, question for Mr. Leon and Mr. Fong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Mr. Leon. Could you tell me specifically what's gone wrong in Oregon?
Mr. Leon.
What's done wrong in Oregon with that is just what I did some reading, and there was less jobs are being created because of it. So just lots of jobs.
And what, Mr.
Representative Metza?
Were there any other things you took into consideration other than the minimum wage increase with that?
No, I just read it. I read with the National Restaurant Association, but I know that, our gentleman here from the Minnesota Restaurant Association can give more information if you'd like.
That'll be fine. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list is J.J. Haywood. Following that is Sonny Bakta, and that one is also not here. Reverend Paul Erickson, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Paul Erickson. I'm a Lutheran pastor, and I serve as assistant to the bishop in the St. Paul Area Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, a geographical cluster of 116 ministries and over 130,000 members in the East Metro area. I'm here today to speak in favor of proposed legislation that would raise the minimum wage in Minnesota to $9.50 an hour by 2015, even though this is still far short of a living wage. While some may question why the faith community or even the government should enter into the employer-employee relationship at all, I firmly believe that if we leave it to the free market to determine the proper wage, workers will continue to be treated as replaceable cogs in an economic machine. Simply put, it's about human dignity. We believe that all human beings are created in God's image. We believe that while we are not defined by our work, we should be able to express our God-given dignity as persons of integrity, worth, and meaning. We believe that people who work full-time hours should not be condemned to live in poverty. You see, I was raised to believe, like many of us, that if you just work hard and follow the rules, you could live a decent life. Sadly, that's not the case when almost 400,000 Minnesota workers make less than $9.50 an hour. And these aren't just students trying to make a little pocket money. These are also moms and dads trying to raise a family and live a dignified life. See, the time has come for Minnesota to reclaim its place, its rightful place as a leader in promoting dignity and equity as core values of a just and free society. The time has come to raise the minimum wage. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next on the list is Patrick Ness. Reverend Erickson, I appreciated the brevity of your comments. And folks in the audience, we're going to try to work through this list tonight. So the better we can stick to testimony that is new and original and be concise, the better off it will be for everyone whose names appear towards the end of the list as well. So please proceed.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, could I give my spot before I go to Alexander Fitzsimmons, I think, who's also ready to get going? I think we missed her on the list. And so.
Yeah, we had skipped her before because she wasn't arrived. But
with your permission.
Absolutely. Ms. Fitzsimmons, if you'd like to come forward. You guys could work together if that's agreeable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And I will say I do have a two-month-old baby at home, so I do appreciate getting to go first. So with that, my name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons. I'm a mom to Francesco, who's 3 and a half, and Giovanni, who is almost 2 months old. And I'm also the Deputy Director of Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. Children's Defense Fund is a statewide organization. We do advocacy, outreach, education, youth development work on a number of issues that impact children and child well-being. And primarily, we work on two issues. One, we work to improve the economic security of families. And number two, we work to improve the well-being of children, especially children who are either at risk or already, what we say, in harm. We really encourage you, we urge you, to look at this issue of raising the minimum wage to $9.50 by 2015 and indexing it within the early childhood and school readiness continuum. We really see this as an early childhood issue. There's a wide array of research that really looks at the relationship between family income and child outcomes. And we want to focus you briefly on the research, two different studies that look at enhanced income during early childhood. And both of these studies, they're both done by a researcher, Greg Duncan, who's done quite a bit of this work for a number of years. One study was done in 2011, and he looked at the impact of $1,000 of income, of annual income during early childhood, and what that means for childhood outcomes. And they followed, what they did is they looked at 10 different public support programs throughout the country, and they looked at what that amount of money does for outcomes. They followed those children between 3 and 5 years later. And what they found is that there was increased school readiness. Children were doing better on math tests, on reading tests, and they found about a 0.5 or 0.6% standard deviation increase, which means it can mean about 1 point in an IQ score. It can also mean about 10% more questions that you've answered correctly on an exam. There are two important pieces from that study. One is that what they said, and this is the important part, is that proportionally, that if that income was increased proportionally, they expected to see proportional increases in the outcomes of children, in child readiness and school readiness. So that's one piece, meaning if we're looking at $2,000, if we're looking at $3,000, we're going to see that increasing in those outcomes as we're looking at the different factors that are examined in these different tests. Secondly, and this is also important, is that what that money was used for. The increases in income that families saw were used to better their children, used on child care, looking at quality child care, looking at early childhood experiences, clothing, and food. The money went to the children. And I know that you are well familiar with the importance of early childhood and the brain development that is happening at a rapid pace during those earliest years and what that means for forming the building blocks for future success in school and also adulthood. I believe that you have a table that also looks at a different study that Greg Duncan did that looked at outcomes. So we looked at, they followed children during early childhood. They looked at whether or not a child was growing up in poverty, if they were at 1 to 2 times the percent of poverty, or if they were higher. And then they looked at adult outcomes. They looked at hours worked. They looked at food stamp usage. They looked at incarceration. They looked at a number of different factors, and they were able to see that children who were not growing up in poverty were having better outcomes in adulthood. The second piece that we want you to consider, and then I will wrap things up, but the second piece is to think about the fact that we have 192,000 Minnesota children living in poverty. We know from JobsNow's work and also the Economic Policy Institute that 137,000 Minnesota children would be impacted by a $9.50 minimum wage increase. That is not an insignificant number. And obviously, we can't say that all of those children would be moved out of poverty. But again, if we just compare those two side by side, 192,000 Minnesota children in poverty and 137,000 kids who would be living in more financially secure households, it is not an insignificant number, and it also means the future of our state. Lastly, we really want to encourage you to index the minimum wage. We need the stability for families, because not only are we talking about economic security, economic stability, we want to be talking about economic prosperity and economic opportunity for these families and for these young children who we care so deeply about. So I leave you with, when we increase family income, we improve child outcomes. The research is there, and we're there. So please, please look at getting this done at 9:50 and having it indexed. So thank you very much for all the work that you've done on this and that you continue to do on this.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Fitzsimmons? No? And Mr. Ness?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patrick Ness, Public Policy Director with the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation in St. Paul. We serve the St. Paul and Greater East Metro for over a century now, and our mission is to improve the lives of low-income children, families, and older adults through direct services, research, community capacity building, and leadership development. We work with over 8,500 people in the East Metro every year, many of those receiving multiple services. Our work in part is about addressing opportunity gaps generated by income, place, and race, and working to improve the disparities in health, education, and income. And we know that the minimum wage points directly to progress in all of those areas. So we come today to call for $9.50 minimum wage index for inflation. It won't solve the problem of poverty rate wages, but it's certainly a step in the right direction. And while the driving factors of poverty are complex and multivariate, one thing is for sure. There are many poor people who are poor because they don't have enough money. So let's do something about that this session. So to talk about indexing, we have 11 states in the U.S. Who do index for inflation. From the president's plan on minimum wage from 2013, states indexing the minimum wage to inflation would help low-income workers keep up in the future. Indexing the minimum wage to inflation would ensure that working families can keep up with expenses and will not suffer if Congress fails to act. We heard earlier from a worker who talked about the price of meat and vegetables going up. We know that the peak real worth of the minimum wage was in 1968. In 1968, adjusted for inflation, it would be $10.69 today. That is 47% higher than the current $7.25 minimum wage. Now, last month, Martin Luther King Day, I was reflecting on the fact that he was in Memphis advocating for the sanitation workers. At the March on Washington, one of the main calls or demands was for an increase in the minimum wage, which was 47% higher than it is today. Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis, standing up for low-wage workers for a wage that was 47% higher than it is today. So let's pass a bill that ensure this never happens again. Let's catch up and then let's keep up. Let's do something today and lock it in, and we will no doubt see the impact in the lives of low-income children and families and all the outcomes that Alexandra spoke of. We can do this. We can do this this session. I thank you for your support and your time.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Kathy Potter is next on the list. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Kathy Potter. I am the Executive Director of Access to the Red River Valley, based in Moorhead, Minnesota. We are an agency that serves children and adults with disabilities. About 95% of our budget does come from the state of Minnesota. Over the last 5 years, two of the years, we received zero COLA increases. Two of those years, we received cuts of between 1.5% and 10%. And in 2013, we received a 0.5% increase to our budget. We have grave concerns about raising the rates to $9.50. I'm proud to admit that as I became the executive director, we have increased our starting wage from $7.50 to $9.25 in 2013. It's been a goal of mine because I do believe we are not a minimum wage employer. We work with children. We work with adults. They have disabilities. We go into their homes. They come into our homes. And it's very important that the people that work for us are well paid. Raising the minimum wage, we would only have to go up a quarter. That doesn't sound like much, but for us, it's $60,000, not a lot. But then we're back to a minimum wage employee, and that is not something we want to be. We want to go back to the $2 above minimum wage. I noticed today when I arrived that the state is looking at providing a reimbursement rate, but going from 7.25 to 9.50, that's 30%. I don't see how that's possible. I hope it happens. That would be awesome. I mean, the 5% increase that we're looking at is just a drop in the bucket to help us catch up a little bit from where we've been. some of the things that I was looking at. I think if they did increase the minimum wage, I mean, I would love it because I just want to see the state reimburse us according to that. We have huge turnover. A lot of our kids are college kids. We're based in Fargo-Moorhead. We have 5 universities around us. A lot of them are doing it for experience. Not all of them are there for a living wage, but that doesn't mean they deserve to make one. We're a border city. Fargo right now is paying a lot of their direct care professionals $15 an hour. How do we compete? I have no idea. We're wishing that more of our employees would be career employees, not just a summer job, something to do to get experience in their profession, because our clients deserve a employee that's there for the long haul and maybe not just for a few months. That's really all I have to say. Is there any questions?
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Ms. Baker, right? I'm sorry.
Potter.
So I was trying to follow your testimony. It sounds like, you were talking about the 5%, which is not what we're talking about here. But it sounds like if you had the ability to pay people more money, you would be able to compete with Fargo and you'd find a person who might want to stay and be in your business as a career as opposed to someone that's just in college that's just kind of passing through. Is that kind of what I heard you say?
That is right. That is part of our issue. I mean, the turnover rate is probably about 60%, and that's huge because we do have a lot of training costs. And by trade, I'm an accountant, so when I took over, I realized to pay that type of a training cost for an employee is astronomical, and if we can increase their wages, maybe they'll stay longer and balance some of those costs out. So we are working very hard to raise our wages, but we're finally hit the wall. I don't know where else we're going to find the money to do that.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Potter, you're saying raising the wages actually would be good for your business?
Oh, you bet. I would love to see that happen, but we cannot raise our rates. We cannot come to the state and say, instead of paying us X amount of dollars, we need this to do it. They tell us what they're going to pay, and we can't reduce ours either. We are vulnerable adults, vulnerable children. We can't say, well, you know what, we're having a shortfall this month. We're just not going to staff our clients. We are 24/7. We have no options.
Good. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm pretty familiar with the work that you do, and so I just wanted to be sure that we were clear. We have to do some things to be able to help you, and I know that we help to reimburse the work that you do for vulnerable Minnesotans, but it is still your testimony that raising a wage is good for your business.
I think raising a wage is good for everybody's business.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No further Representative Metza.
Yeah, more comment, and thank you for the hard work you do, or thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the
hard work, Representative Metza. Thank you.
I know, and with me sometimes.
Yeah.
So I just really, this kind of hits close to home for me. I recently had a friend who had moved back from your neck of the woods to my neck of the woods, and 2 kids, and she checked herself into a mental health facility to get by for a little bit with stress because she couldn't find a job. Even when she gets out, chances are she won't be able to afford a place with the deposits and stuff. So we've been working on some programs, and I just wanted to let you know that I took the time in Senator Tomasoni and I's district to make sure that we were addressing some of those, and I know the Senate's been pushing very hard for that 5%, and it would be something that we'd like to see, so hopefully someday that you could compete with North Dakota, who's paying a wage that should be paid to take care of these people.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Aaron Parrish.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it's my honor to be here today. My name is Erin Parrish. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Women's Consortium. We are a statewide organization of 132 organizations and 4,200 individuals across the state of Minnesota. All of them are committed to advancing equity and justice for women and girls. I'm here to testify in support of raising the minimum wage and respectfully urge your vote in support of this bill. Minnesota is a national leader in women's workforce participation. While the number of working mothers has declined nationally in recent years, it has only increased in Minnesota. Workforce participation of mothers with children under 6 has increased the most, and it's now at 79%. With increasing numbers of women breadwinners, the double disadvantage of lower wages across almost all occupations and lower wages in female-dominated professions,
affects our families and communities in this state. Not only are female-dominated occupations compensated at lower levels overall, women in these occupations generally earn less than men in the same occupation. Among hourly workers in Minnesota, young workers and women are more likely to be paid the minimum wage or less. Because of this and the fact that they made up 53% of all hourly workers, women accounted for 60% of all hourly workers at or below the minimum wage. Because too many women are segregated in low-wage work, minimum wage is a gender issue in our state. Raising the minimum wage to $9.50 an hour would mean better wages for roughly 202,000 women in this state. The Minnesota Women's Consortium supports laws and statutes that allow women to reach their full potential. Minnesota's current minimum wage law does not allow all women in Minnesota to reach their full economic potential. It does not allow them to get to a level of economic security that's necessary to support their children and their families. Too many women are in poverty in this state, and too many more are one medical emergency, one broken down car, or one missed paycheck away from poverty. We feel at the Minnesota Women's Consortium that when women do better, families do better, and Minnesota as a state does better. So I ask you to vote yes to raise the minimum wage to $9.50. Thank you for your time today.
Seeing no questions, thank you for your testimony. Ben Anderson is next. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ben Anderson. I'm a member of the Catholic religious order of vowed religious in the Society of Jesus, known as the Jesuits, living in a community in Minneapolis. And I'm assigned to work in churches, especially Catholic Latino parishes, with Isaiah. Isaiah is a group of 100 congregations in Minnesota working for economic and racial justice. I'm here speaking out of my faith. And Catholic social teaching clearly states that work was made for humans, not humans for work. Work is to support the dignity of the person, their families, and their communities. And so I'm testifying in support of the $9.50 minimum wage. This is because of the current level of poverty wages that causes pain and crisis in families, and this violates the dignity of the human person. In my visits to home of families in the parishes across the Twin Cities, mostly in suburban communities, there are few families who don't talk about the stress of working, often in two jobs, on poverty wages, and are still barely making it by. I've seen how working poverty wages put stress on people having to work so many hours and still not pay the checks. It is not simply the stress on the checkbook that causes this, but the stress on their health, their marriages, and their families, and creates trauma and brokenness in families and our entire community. The shocks of this are felt beyond the individual, but in our neighborhoods and in our churches, and it is not what God has called our community to be. A living wage will greatly help and be a factor in stopping this wound from growing and moving towards its healing. $9.50 is not enough, as a living wage is much more, but $9.50 will make a great difference, and families cannot wait. Please pass and make effective as soon as possible the $9.50 wage. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Metza.
I know I'm setting myself up, Mr. Chair, for a call from my Nona, my Catholic grandmother, but would you say it's a good thing, and would it be your advice to Minnesota Catholics to support this?
Do I address you as Father Anderson? Is that the correct appellation, or do you
no? I'm a vowed religious, not a priest. So similar to a nun in a religious order.
So an ordinary Mister.
Yes,
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Anderson, S.J. I would say that it is coherent and consistent with Catholic social teaching to support, and coherent with the values of the gospel and Christian faith to support this increase in the minimum wage.
Thank you, and just wanted to say thank you for going into the service that you do. I have one uncle that's a monk at St. John's and one that's a priest just halfway down the road there on 94. So,
you're welcome.
Thank you. Next on the list, Dane Smith. I think we have Ms. Ramirez. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Maureen Ramirez from Growth and Justice. I'm here in place of Dean Smith tonight. I'm from Growth and Justice. I'm Policy and Research Director there. We're a think tank focused on public policies that can grow our economy and make it more just at the same time. We think raising the minimum wage is one of these policies. We wrote recently about widening income inequality in Minnesota and its effects, one of which is reduced consumer spending. I'd just like to read from that report. Income inequality has crossed a threshold that threatens overall growth and is an issue of great importance. Economic inequality in Minnesota and the United States, by every measure, continues to widen. When incomes at the top are growing much more quickly than those in the middle and the bottom of the distribution, consumption naturally declines as a share of our GDP. Slowing economic growth leads to increased inequality, which then can lead to even slower growth. Nationally, the growth rate in personal consumption expenditures has been declining for almost 50 years, according to the Bureau of Economic Analysis National Income and Product Accounts. From a high of 6.3% annual growth in personal consumption in 1965, the growth rate has fallen to 2.2% in 2012. The increased $472 million in annual consumer spending power, which we estimate could result from a $9.50 an hour minimum wage, would be one step towards strengthening Minnesota's consumer economy. Raising the Minnesota minimum wage to $9.50 would improve the income of 357,000 working Minnesotans across the demographic spectrum and would increase consumer spending power, giving a much-needed boost to sales at local businesses. Indexing the $9.50 wage to inflation will help ensure that the wage would maintain its value over time rather than, again, falling behind the cost of living. The new $9.50 an hour wage would not fully restore the value lost to inflation since 1968, and it would not bring the minimum wage in line with the cost of living for families or individuals in Minnesota, but it would bring us a step closer to a living wage.
Thank you. Seeing no questions, we will move on. There are two substitutions I'm going to put in now based on requests we've had. The first will be Ms. Schroeder, Julie Schroeder. And the second, Representative Marion
O'Neill.
I was stuck on Marion Green, my friend from a former session. Marion O'Neill has also asked to testify, so I'll take you after Ms. Schroeder. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Julie Schroeder, and I own a small business in Eagan, Minnesota called Color Me Mine. It's a paint-your-own pottery studio. I opened it because I wanted to work in the community. I wanted to offer jobs. I wanted to work to offer something fun for the residents of Eagan. I've now purchased the studio in Rochester, so I will employ 20 people. I morally would love to pay everybody at least $9.50. The reason I opened was so that I could employ people. I cannot afford to start a lot of these girls, a lot of high school girls, at $9.50 an hour and have them move up from there. I have a very low profit margin, and I just cannot afford it. Not only does it increase my pay, but payroll taxes go up as you pay higher wages. So my payroll taxes will go up according to the higher amounts of pay that I'm paying my employees, which doesn't just increase from my lowest is $8 an hour, $1.50, but it increases the amount of taxes I have to pay as well. I also employ a gal from PROACT who is a special needs adult. I love being a part of that company and helping out, but she washes dishes for me on the weekends. And I can't afford to pay her $9.50 an hour when someone else within my organization could very easily do that. I don't really need her there, but I love employing her. I love that she has the opportunity to work in a company and feel important and that she is valued. But her value to my organization cannot keep going up, and I can't stay open. The other thing I wanted to point out when you asked about percentage in my business, my payroll is 40% of what I take in. So any kind of increase is a huge chunk of my very low profit margin. So I, like I said, I would love to pay them more, but to force me to pay more will probably force me to lose 20 jobs in the community.
Thank you. Seeing no questions, we will go on to Representative O'Neill. And Representative O'Neill, I feel like as a legislator, you especially need the warning to stick to 2 to 3 minutes. Not about you personally, just the office that you hold.
Well, thank you, Representative Winkler. And for the record, my name is Representative Marion O'Neill. And if those of you who have served in committee with me know that I am short and brief and to the point. So thank you for that. Representative Winkler, I thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today along with the public. And the reason I'm here, you're probably wondering why in the world I'm even here, but I felt compelled after speaking to the business sector that the Republican voice is not on the committee. So as I look around the room, I see wonderful Democrat senators, wonderful Democrat House members, but I don't see representation from my caucus. And I would have loved to see Representative Garofalo, Representative Loon, Representative Kiefer as a part of this conference committee, but that did not happen. And so that's a great concern within the business sector. So I actually have been asked just to speak ever so briefly, and thank you, Representative Winkler, that you pointed out that you haven't seen me since maybe the last time your bill was in my committee. And let me tell you what I've been doing in the interim since I haven't been a part of this committee, the Living Wage Committee. I've actually been touring around Minnesota, and I'm the Small Business Caucus co-chair with Representative Rosenthal. It's a 26-member caucus. I'm not here to represent that caucus, but let me just say that in that time, I've listened to a lot of business owners, and there certainly were many, many businesses represented here this afternoon and evening. And it seems to be a reverberating theme that what they will have to do if minimum wage goes up as much as $9.50 per hour, which would be a 65% increase, is cut hours, lay off employees, raise prices. Those are the same three things that I've been hearing month after month after month after month from business owners. The other part that made me pause is when I started touring the nursing homes and the disability homes, and you had someone here that represented that voice and that population saying that they are really stuck between a rock and a hard place. If minimum wage goes up and their rate does not go up, what do they do? So I would implore you to think about that as you consider this. And, you know, I don't need to look any farther than what just happened in these last 3 days with the repeal of the warehouse tax. And I carried a bill to repeal that, and I was graciously given the ability to present my bill before the tax committee on the first day of session, which I greatly appreciate. But I think it's very imperative that we take a look at the warehouse industry before the tax was even enacted. The warehouses, as reported by the business owners, are nearly empty. I think it's important to listen to the business owners and give them credence today, that if they say that they have to cut hours, cut people, or raise prices, that is what they're going to do. You don't have to look any farther than what happened with warehouse tax just these last 3 days. I think that what we should be considering is a concern for our competitiveness, our competitiveness here in Minnesota. Are we going to, if we raise the minimum wage up to $9.50 an hour, are we going to remain regionally competitive, nationally competitive, internationally competitive? I think that's something that you should really consider. I don't think I've heard that yet from the testimony. But it's imperative that we look at the region, the nation, and globally, because Minnesota is a great place to do business, some would say, some would not. I had a business owner actually tell me who in the blank would open a business in Minnesota in the current climate. I won't use the word that he used in this testimony, but it's a concern. It's a great concern. I think maybe a different question that we should be looking at instead of what should the minimum wage go up to? And, you know, I wish Representative Metso was still here because he and I had a very interesting conversation in the hallway, as most conversations transpire between legislators, and that's sometimes where the real work is done. And his question to me was, well, what would your caucus agree to? What number? What's the number? What's the number? Well, I'm not going to give you a number. I don't have a number. But I can tell you that you should listen to what the business owners are saying. And I think by and large, every business owner that I've listened to very carefully said 950 is too much. Now, the Senate version is nowhere near that. But please, I implore you to listen to the business owners today and take what they're saying as very serious. Again, warehouse tax. Finally, I think that we need to look at, maybe we need to think about a different question. Now, this is something you probably don't know about me, but I served over 10 years working in the field of nonprofit. I've served on boards of food shelves and done the nitty-gritty. I worked day in and day out to help them. I worked for Minnesota Teen Challenge. I've worked for the field of nonprofit for over 10 years, but I also own a business. And I think maybe the greater question that we need to ask is, how can we raise the skill of the people that are below 950? How can we help them increase their skills and thereby increase their earning potential? And maybe that is the greater question and not doing a minimum wage up to $9.50 per hour. Thank you.
And Representative O'Neill, I would just point out that when I came to the legislature in 2006 under the DFL majority, there was no rule that you had to have voted for a bill in order to serve on a conference committee.
Well said.
When your party was in charge for 2 years, that rule was adopted. And I don't necessarily agree with it, but that seems to be the current rule of the legislature, that unless you vote for a bill, you will not be serving on a conference committee. And so when you look around the table and see only DFL members of the legislature, it's because all the members here voted for the respective bill in their chamber. And I also would point out that we have already had 2 hours of testimony. We have a long list of people here to go. I think we've been very fair in making sure that everyone's had an opportunity to be heard, business voices included. And I don't think we're short of listening. In fact, the last time you and I talked about this was in Senator Amy Koch's bowling alley, where I went to have a conversation and a debate about this very topic. So I think we can all say that we've been listening pretty carefully and that this process has been fair.
Representative
O'Neill, before you go, I was so first of all, thank you for your testimony and thank you for being here late. I don't know if I wasn't sitting on the conference committee that I would be here, but I really like your dedication. I think that's fantastic. I did have a question for you, though. You had said that you had spent some time in the interim going around the state talking to business owners about our proposals, and I think that all of us have done, and if we hadn't, I'm sure people were coming to us. The question I have for you is, did you talk to the people who work for the business owners?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. Yes, I did. I did. Thank you. I talked to the owners. I talked to the employees. Yes, I did.
And did you, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, did you get a sense or some type of tally? Because, I mean, you were very precise that the business owners said that they were, you know, they would raise the cost. They would let people go. They would change their hours. So it sounds like you really had an emphasis there. Could you tell me some of the feedback you got just independently of that issue of when you went to a person work there and says, would you like to have a 950 or a 778, but would you like to have a raise, and how would that affect you and how would that affect your family? And if you did, what did they tell you?
And Representative O'Neill, I'm going to give you a chance to answer the question. I know Senator or Representative Metza has a question as well, and we can really do a great job of demonstrating our ability to have partisan or cross-party debate here tonight, but what I want to focus on is hearing from members of the public. So we'll do this quickly. Representative Metz, I hope you don't mind, but I'm not.
Well, you know what, Mr. Chair, she doesn't have to answer that question, but I think that this is kind of a lesson for us that if you come and you sit down in that chair, then we're going to have a lot of questions to ask you, and I would much more prefer that to do that as you guys do it on the House floor or back and forth from the Senate floor, but if you come and you start to kind of make those assertions, we're going to ask you a lot of questions, Representative O'Neill. But, Mr. Chair, for the sake of time and everybody else, I'll yield to, we don't yield, but I'll allow Representative Metz or I will not speak anymore.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Hayden. I guess I'll just leave this, and maybe it's a question that you can just be a vessel for, Representative.
She covered it when you were out of the room. What would they take?
No. I heard about that, by the way. it would be, if we pass this bill at the 950 level, do you believe your caucus would next year, if they thought it were inappropriate, lower the minimum wage?
Representative Neal, would you like to answer that question?
Or try.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Metza, you know, I'm not really here to speak on behalf of my caucus, unfortunately. As you and I had that conversation in the hallway about what number would my caucus take, we are both freshmen, right? And so I'm not going to speak on behalf of my leadership. I can't predict what the, you know, if by chance the Republicans take control of the House in this next election, I cannot tell you what they would do for the minimum wage. Because there we are a bicameral, right, legislator, so we have to work with the Senate, which would still be in control of your party, so I don't know that much would change, or, you know, how could that change without an agreement? So I really can't say to that, but the only other point I would say to just very, very quickly is I did tour Hennepin Technical College, where I talked to a lot of people that were getting retrained, and I did talk to a lot of places that employ people with a starting wage after 2 years of about $80,000, which would be a CNC operator or other places in manufacturing, and one out of seven employees in the state of Minnesota are in manufacturing. So, you know, maybe that's the better question to ask, is how can we get people more employable?
Thank you. Mr. Hickey?
You must just stop being...
Mr. Chairman, members, Mike Hickey, the National Federation of Independent Business. It's kind of hard to follow a partisan caucus battles here. I mean, this may be a little boring. This might be the typical
thing. We're ready for a change of pace, Mr. Hickey.
Maybe the typical thing you hear from me, so I'll see if I can go at it with brevity and maybe spice it up a little bit. But as many of you know, National Federation of Independent Business is the state's largest business group in terms of entities, with 13,000 members and a significant member base in every district, and we do have a lot of members who are affected by this issue. We're very concerned about the 950 proposal. We feel it's unaffordable. We feel it's going to cause job loss, and it's going to especially take away job opportunities for young people. I think you have to be mindful as you are in the final deliberations on this issue. Minimum wage is never intended to be a living wage. And the statistics bear that out. It's a starting wage, and hopefully a lot of people, most people, move up to a better wage and move on in the job market. And you must be mindful of that. Statistics do bear that out. 21% of all minimum wage earners are family heads or spouses working full-time. 69% of workers earning the minimum wage are part-time workers. Getting ahead of myself, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, only 2.8% of hourly workers in Minnesota earn the minimum wage. I think you need to keep that in mind to keep in perspective what's the totality of what you're dealing with here. 53% of the minimum wage earners are under age 25, the very young ages. 56% come from a family that has an income above 200% of the federal poverty line. And finally, the average family income of a minimum wage worker is $49,885. In a lot of cases, minimum wage workers are second, third, and a fourth income in a family, and you need to be mindful of that, too. Many economists have done analysis about job loss and the minimum wage. I'm just going to cite a couple of them to you for brevity's sake, but economist David Newmark at the University of California, Irvine, his analysis shows that every 10% increase in the minimum wage, teen employment declined by 4.6 to 9%. A recent study by Ball State University shows when the minimum wage was last increased, 550,000 part-time jobs disappeared. And as many of you heard last week, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office projected that with a $10.10 minimum wage, which is being discussed in Washington, we'd lose 500,000 jobs across the United States. And virtually all economists take this point of view. Our real concern here is that at 950, a lot of jobs for young people are going to disappear because employers just aren't going to be able to afford it. And I don't know what they're going to do. They're going to hire, make more people full-time, but to spend a lot of time with a very young person who's maybe never had a work experience and I know they get the training wage, but once that ends, a lot of these jobs are long-term, I wouldn't say permanent, but long-term part-time jobs. And so the training wage can cushion the start, but on a 91st day, they are going to have to pay the full wage, and depending on what level they are and where the business is at. And so very concerned about those opportunities disappearing for people, because I just don't believe employers are going to pay a teenager $9.50 an hour who's done virtually nothing. And 3 months is not a long time to train somebody. And so I think that's probably the biggest aspect we're going to see from this. We do appreciate the more reasonable approach the Senate has taken on this. I think the Senate was mindful of many of these concerns. And finally, I just want to conclude by saying that we are strongly opposed to the escalator provision. Lawmakers need to vote on this. And from time to time, the legislature, the Congress, is going to raise the minimum wage, and it sure looks like you're going to do it this year, Mr. Chairman. And you guys are going to vote for this, and people need to be accountable on it. Going on the escalator, we could run the risk of having a runaway minimum wage if we run into high inflationary times. Who knows where that wage would go? It would be pegged to an automatic escalator provision we have, and we'd have to count on the legislature somehow breaking through the gridlock and getting rid of that to negate a runaway minimum wage. So we think putting it on automatic pilot, not having the members of the legislature be responsible for the wage at a given time is a mistake. You need to be accountable for it. And obviously, you know, you're deliberating on it this year with every intention to do something, and that's the way it should be. So I appreciate the time tonight, and I urge you to tread carefully on this issue.
Mr. Hickey, I have two questions. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, Mr. Hickey, you referred to family incomes at $49,000. I wanted to know if you had ages to correlate with this, or if you know people who are keeping their kids and combining that income for that household of 49, like how did you get that, and how is that relevant to what their bills and their individual needs are?
Mr. Hickey.
As I read the statistic, it's a family income, so that's a combined income, so that would count the minimum wage into it as I read the statistic. And the point is that a lot of these minimum wage earners are coming from families and are second, third, and fourth income in a family.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey, and Mr. Chair. So I'm curious again with that, at the $49,000 in family income, how is it relevant what we'd lay out as a minimum wage? How do you combine that in? When is it our job to take into consideration what a parent does? If their child's 18, aren't they on their own and making their own decisions, trying to make their own way in life? Or do you believe that kids should be dependent on their parents for much longer?
Mr. Hickey.
Mr. Chairman, I take the stat at face value, and it shows that a lot of people are working part-time at the minimum wage. It's not they're not head of a household. That's what the other stat says, the 21%. Only 21% are head of a household. So it just shows that people, it's a lot of times it's the second or third income, and I just take the stat at face value. I mean, interpret it any way you want. It's a statistic. So,
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hickey, I just want to, maybe I'm channeling Representative Metza. What's the number you like? What do you think? What does your organization think that the minimum wage number should be?
Mr. Hickey.
Senator Hayden, that's a little above my pay grade, and most of this is beyond out of my control. As you can see, I'm sitting here and you're sitting up there. But we certainly like the Senate bill a lot better. We know the Senate's not going to carry the day, and there's got to be a negotiation. But the fact that, you know, you've treaded carefully on this, you've charted a moderate course and a reasonable course, we appreciate it. I'm not here to give you a number tonight. That's above my pay grade.
So, Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. So, Mr. Hickey, I wasn't in the committee when it was heard. Did you testify in favor of the bill when it was in the Senate?
I think I just testified on the issue. I didn't testify in favor, no.
Oh, okay. No. Well, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Hickey. And I just assume that that's what it is. That, I mean, we don't really have a lot of advice from the business community on what it should be if there was a number. We haven't got a lot of advice from my friends across the aisle on what it should be. And typically when this thing goes through, you guys don't support any of it. So I just don't think that there's anything that you like about either one of these bills, and I just think we should say that. I appreciate you being honest and reading statistics. You know, I've been reading statistics that I don't know what the research comes from, if it's a left-leaning or a right-leaning group, but I just think that part of what our responsibility is here, but your responsibility as leaders, is to give us advice as to what it does look like. It appears that we have a problem. It appears that we have many, many people in poverty. It appears that we have lost many, many middle-class jobs. We hear it all the time. And so what Mr. Chair, I know it's getting late, but so I don't want to make a long speech, but what I'm starting to understand is,
longer.
Like, what is it that you want? And what is the right wage? And how do we kind of work our way through it? And so, Mr. Hickey, I didn't even put you on the spot. You don't really have to answer that, but I think it just makes the point that it doesn't seem like you guys like much at all, and or you're not giving us advice as to what the appropriate wage would be.
Mr. Hickey, would you like to respond?
Yeah, well, actually, Senator Hayden, we'd prefer to keep it in sync with the federal wage. And when the federal, we have a lot of businesses near the borders. We have four borders. We prefer to keep it in sync with the federal. And when they do act, then it goes up and it's the same everywhere. That's what we prefer. The choice between the House and the Senate bill, obviously, we take the Senate bill. Appreciate the more cautious approach you've taken.
And Mr. Hickey, I would just point out that you may have not had the benefit of hearing the side-by-side, but the House bill inflation is capped at 2.5%, so your concern about the runaway inflation, I think, is addressed in the House bill. With no further questions, I move on to Dave Baker. Not seeing Mr. Baker, next on the list is Toby Pearson.
Mr. Chair, members, if you'll allow us, Carrie Thurlow would like to join me. We're the long-term care imperative when we're here at the Capitol, so we often do our testimony in conjunction with each other.
Please proceed.
We've given the page some handouts that will help you follow along with what our presentation is going to be. For those who don't know, the long-term care imperative is a collaboration of aging services and care providers in Minnesota. We represent the nursing homes, two of the state's largest long-term care associations. We do nursing homes, elderly waiver, housing with services providers, so a variety of providers. We're here mostly to talk about the impact of raising the minimum wage with nursing homes. So if you start out with the highlights page, we'll just run through this real quickly so you can get a grasp of what we're talking about. The primary source of funding for nursing facilities are the state and federal governments. So Minnesota sets the rates for Medicaid and private pay clients. There's a state statute basically called rate equalization, which says you can't charge private pay clients more than the Medicaid rate. The interesting thing about that that makes nursing homes different than a lot of other businesses is that that means you can't just raise your price on folks. Unless the state raises the Medicaid rate, the nursing home can't charge more. There's an underfunding in Medicaid that we'll cover later on as to how much that underfunding is. And the federal government sets the rates for Medicare, and those have been getting cut in recent memory. The labor market for caregivers has returned to pre-recession levels. What that means is a lot of our nursing homes struggle to compete for recruiting and retaining employees. Again, it relates back to what the Medicaid rate is and whether or not we can afford to pay more. 7.9% of nursing facilities employees earn less than $9.50 an hour, but it varies considerably across the state. 47% earn less than $13 an hour. There are direct and indirect impacts economically for nursing homes. The indirect impacts we often refer to as what is basically the ripple effect. So if you turn the page, on page 2 there's a map, and I already told our data guy you need to change the color so that they stand out a little differently. But basically what this does is this breaks down. Statewide there's about 8% of folks in our nursing homes that are making less than $9.50 an hour. And this just shows you some of the distribution of where those folks are and the concentrations in different areas. The positions that are most impacted by the increase in the minimum wage would be the nursing assistants, food service and dietary aides, housekeeping, laundry, cooks, blended workers, a lot of the workers within the facilities. The next slide is the one that is titled Percent of Nursing Facility Revenue by Payer Source, and this goes again back to the restrictions that are on nursing homes and why they can't simply raise the rates or charge people more. You set the rates for Medicaid, which is 50% of the income. Private pay is 23%. Those are tied to the Medicaid rates. Medicare is 16%. And then there's a small chunk that are third-party payers. This would be people who are like long-term care insurance or commercial insurance. Some of our nursing homes will do rehab work for folks who are under 65 who aren't necessarily on Medicare. MSHO and MSC Plus would be also in that category. So the projected shortfall between Medicaid reimbursement and allowable Medicaid costs in Minnesota is $34.44. You set the rates. They're $34.44 below the allowable costs. The reason we have North Dakota on there is because North Dakota is the other state that has rate equalization, and their rates are only 92 cents below the allowable costs. So there's been a long history the last 5 years. Last year was a great step. We'd like to say again thank you for voting for an increase for the nursing homes last year. But this proposal that we will have with minimum wage really only keeps us at the state we're at. It doesn't bring us ahead any longer. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Carrie.
Thanks, Toby. And for the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Senior Vice President of Advocacy for Aging Services of Minnesota, also appearing tonight on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Toby did a great job in the first few slides showing the direct impact of the minimum wage, bringing those workers in nursing facilities that would have to come up. And again, we're assuming an increase up to the $9.50 rate. The next series of slides that I'll share with you really demonstrate why you also have to address the spillover effect for those employees that are making just over $9.50. And Toby alluded to it in his initial comments, but these next slides really kind of highlight the need. And that is the increasing workforce shortage we have in even our licensed and direct care staff in nursing homes. On page 8, you'll see that there are shortages throughout the state for direct care workers, currently exceeding over 1,800 in all open positions. And you can see it broken down by RN, LPNs, and registered nursing assistants. And that's been a phenomenon that we face, that we're facing, and is continuing to get worse. On page 9, you'll see that we're also facing huge problems with turnover. So not only do we have vacant positions out there, difficulty filling our positions, but we're having an increasing problem in keeping the workers that we have. And again, you'll see the breakdown here of turnover rates in the typical job cap, an increasing problem in keeping the workers that we have. And again, you'll see the breakdown here of turnover rates in the typical job categories. For nursing assistants in particular, I'll point out that it's hovering at almost 50% turnover rate. And then the last slide that I'll share with you in terms of data with regard to turnover rates is on slide 10. And this is really the based on our most recent survey of our nursing home members, the turnover rate of nursing assistants and medication aides. And it's a breakdown regionally throughout the state. Interestingly, if you put this graph along next to the map that Toby shared with you with regard to the direct impact, you'll see that some of those same regions that are most impacted with the direct impact also have some significant turnover rates in the state. So the last slide here is really page 11. We know that you are seeking solutions. We want to be clear that we want to pay our workers more. That we're not opposed to increasing the wages of our workers, but we need help doing that. And we've chatted with some of you already about some ideas that we have to address that, a proposal that we have. We'll be meeting with more of you. And this slide really just kind of highlights some of the key elements of that proposal. We feel that it's important to address not only the direct impacts of raising those workers making less than $9.50 an hour, raising those folks up, but also addressing the ripple effect. Of those costs, and we've done considerable research on how you can do that. We would propose that a mechanism to do that is to require nursing facilities to submit information to our Department of Human Services to calculate potential increases, and then also have facilities submit a plan to DHS for approval on how they would distribute any rate increases back through wages to ensure that the money gets to those low-wage workers and the money is actually creating wage increases for our employees. We also feel that it's important that that these wage increases, these increases be targeted to the facilities that are most directly impacted by this minimum wage increase. And so this is somewhat unusual for us to come forward with a proposal, but they would be facility-specific increases, again, so that looking at that map that Toby shared with you earlier, that we're actually getting the largest increases to those facilities that would be most impacted by the minimum wage increase. Currently, we are refining our model. We do have a model to make this all happen, and we have shared it with some folks. We continue to work with stakeholders. But our model is based on deed data, the Medicaid statistical cost report data, and also independent economic research and consultation with researchers such as economists at the University of Minnesota. One thing that I would point out is that our approach and our proposed solution to addressing our problem will only preserve the status quo sort of with nursing homes. It will address the impacts of the minimum wage. It won't address the underlying issue that we face with the chronic underfunding of Medicaid rates. So while this will prevent us from sliding back and absorbing additional impacts from the minimum wage increase, it doesn't really move us forward in addressing the shortfall on Medicaid rates. But and again, we have ideas on how to address that those issues as well, probably best saved for a different committee as well. So with that, I think both Toby and I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. I just have Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Thurlow, thank you for the great proposal, you and Mr. Pearson. So what do you attribute the lack of the rapid turnover in your business or the groups of nursing homes that you are there in your consortium? What is the reason for it, or what does your research tell you?
Ms. Thurlow?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, I think there's a variety of reasons for the turnover rate in the settings that we have. Probably not the least amongst them are the wages that we are able to pay. We didn't bring that data with us today, but it's very difficult for us to compete within the healthcare sector. It's no secret that hospitals can pay licensed staff significantly more than we can due to our shortfall in our rates. But we also are finding it increasingly difficult to compete outside the healthcare sector, especially with those staff that may not be licensed. We're competing with Menards. We're competing with other employers. Maybe it's because the work is slightly easier in those settings. Maybe it's because they can actually afford to pay more in outside a nursing home. So wages are an important factor, but it's difficult work. Any of you that may have worked in a nursing home before, you know it's emotionally challenging and it's physically challenging. And so turnover will always be a challenge. And we have other ideas for addressing kind of our broad workforce solutions, but we know that wages are an important component of that.
Well, thank you, Ms. Thurlow, Ms. Chair. I think that was it. I mean, we talk a lot on the Health and Human Service Committee, and I think there's a lot of work, and most of this is probably better suited for there. But I do think that the work that people do, it's caring, but it is hard, and that there are a lot of competing challenges in terms of why people work in long-term care facilities and why they leave. And so I would hope that we weren't just simply saying by raising the minimum wage that would be the sole reason and exacerbate why your organizations would not be able to thrive. I do think that, I was talking to Senator Tomasoni, that this is a real issue and we need to, you know, really think about the Medicaid rates. But I do think that there are a lot of factors as to why people decide to go to work in a long-term care facility and why they decide to leave. And without real clear data from you, I just wouldn't attribute all of that to the raising of the minimum wage.
And Ms. Thurlow.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, and to be clear, we agree. We think there's a multifaceted solution, and we have lots of ideas that we'd be happy to visit with you about.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, we will move on to David Chrysler. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is David Preisler. I'm the executive director for the Minnesota Pork Producers Association, and I work for people that raise pigs for a living in rural Minnesota. And our farms provide good quality jobs that pay well and also provide benefits and really benefit rural Minnesota's economy. I'm going to talk about something that's a little bit different today. Before I do that, though, I just want to be clear that we do represent farms of all sizes. We have farms that don't have any employees. We have farms that may have one or two. We have farms that may have a few hundred. And we've got folks kind of across the spectrum. We've got about 1,000 total farms that would actually have employees. There are more hog farms than that in the state, but about half of them are more traditional, where they would not actually hire labor. It would just be the labor is provided by the family themselves. I'm going to talk about a little bit different part of this bill compared to what you've heard from all the other testifiers this evening and earlier this afternoon, and that is on the overtime piece. And so if you look at the side-by-side on page 4, it addresses an exemption that for overtime for farm employees. And I want to be real clear about the definition of an agricultural employee. There are some folks that have looked at that as, does that mean that people that work in processing, would be encompassed under that? And no, it's not. The federal definition of this are folks that actually just work on a farm. And so currently in Minnesota, and we would ask that this remain the same, for farm employees, overtime is paid after 48 hours. Now, one of the things that a lot of folks don't realize, and again, we would encourage that stay at that point within this discussion and at the end of this bill. One of the things that folks don't realize is that if we look at the federal law regarding overtime, again, for agricultural employees, is that there is a complete exemption. Okay, so if we look at our neighboring states, so if we look at Iowa, Wisconsin, North and South Dakota, there is no threshold that exists for paying overtime, because no overtime is paid for agricultural employees because they operate under that federal exemption. We think it's responsible, if we're going to be a responsible employer, that we don't know quite honestly if that's quite the right thing to do. And that's why we're not arguing about the 48-hour piece, but we, to remove it, but we would like it to stay. There are things that happen on the farm that get pretty unpredictable. Obviously, this winter is one of them. There have been a whole lot of hours that have been spent shoveling snow and doing things that maybe aren't the typical thing that you would end up doing. And so just as we look at weather and scheduling and so on, to have some of that flexibility is important. Again, our employers, the employers that I work with, and we did a lot of work with seeing exactly whatever their salaries and so on are at. These are good quality jobs, and so I'm not going to talk to the issues around the minimum wage piece. I just want to talk more about the issues around overtime, and ask that be maintained.
Thank you. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess from my constituents' point of view, we farm rocks and can pay a pretty good living, and overtime, really good overtime, actually. What makes you different, other than the federal conformity side of it? I mean, I just haven't been able to wrap my head around why someone who works 40 hours in one industry can't get paid the same as everyone else.
Sure.
Mr. Preisler.
One of the biggest pieces is that, and there are some other businesses that may be in this category too, but in a way we're price takers. We compete in an international and a national marketplace where we're price takers. We are at the bottom rung from a standpoint of what happens with pricing. We get what the packer will give us, and then obviously that ends up working its way up, and so it's at a pretty basic level. And we've got some years where we make money, and we've got some years where we don't make money. And again, this exemption has been in there. As we look to try and compete, again, with our neighboring states that don't have to pay any overtime at all, that gets to be a little bit of a deep hole for us to try to get out of.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up. So I guess I still am curious as to the reasoning. I'll go a little bit off on the side here now on that. With the, I guess, workforce that you have, what is a typical pay scale?
Sure.
Chrysler.
Thanks for the question. If we look at folks that, and we did a salary survey of farms, and again, this is a wide range of farms, large, small. There really isn't that much difference from a large farm to a small farm. That's one thing that we found. You know, people are really just trying to compete for employees. Probably the biggest thing that we found is that, as far as differences, is just where they're located geographically. You know, so what other employer are they competing with in that area? Okay, so obviously we don't have any hog farms in Ramsey or Hennepin County. So, I mean, we're not dealing with those wages, but with our survey, if we look at somebody that has no experience, no education, no training, so I mean they are just plain green. They may start, quite honestly, cleaning the barn, okay, or pressure washing the barn. The range for that, this is starting, okay, and benefits on top of this is from $10 to $14 an hour, okay, with the mean of $11.80. Employees that have been then on the farm, they may have started at that wage, but after 18 to 24 months, the range is 13 to 16 and a half, the mean 14.60. After 3 to 5 years, the range $13 to $23 an hour, with a mean of 17.30. Part of the reason for that big range is that on a number of the farms, they may supply that employee a vehicle, and so if they're giving them a pickup to drive, they may back the wage off a little bit. And again, 90% of the folks that we talk with offer health insurance, 100% offered retirement.
Thank you, Mr. Metza.
One last, I guess, just bit of advice. I'd be more than happy. We deal with a global market where the price is kind of put on us as well. I'd love to put you in touch with the mining companies up in my district if you'd like to know how they work with that and continue to pay overtime.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Preisler. Next person on the list is Chris Stinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Chris Stinson. I'm the policy director for Outfront Minnesota. Our mission is to create a state where lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people are free to be who they are, love who they love, and live without fear of violence, harassment, or discrimination. And the numbers that I'll share with you are from the Williams Institute. They're national numbers. There are no Minnesota numbers because LGBT people are often left out of the discussion of disparities. So the myth of the affluent gay man does not tell the true story of our community. LGBT people face the same socioeconomic challenges faced by people who share their race, sex, ethnicity, age, and disability, along with unique obstacles that come from our sexual orientation and gender identities. More than a quarter of bisexual women are poor. Transgender people are more than four times as likely to have a household income under $10,000. More than one in five lesbians lived in poverty. And similarly, a greater percent of gay and bisexual men fell at or below the poverty line than heterosexual men. You've already heard about the challenges facing female-headed households. I just want to say that many of our families are female-headed households. Children in same-sex households are almost twice as likely to live in poverty. African-American children in gay male households have the highest poverty rate of any children in any household type. Poverty rate greater than 50%. There's been some discussion about paying kids. I wasn't planning on talking about that issue, but there are a number of kids who are LGBT who are kicked out of their homes when they come out to their parents, and they've got tough lives and no good choices. Making sure that their work pays enough to keep them off the street, I think, would be a noble goal. So you've got a chance to lift a lot of our families out of poverty and guarantee that raise you give them it keeps its value. Thanks.
Thank you. Next on the list is Gretchen Vanderlinden Wang. Please identify yourself officially for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Gretchen Vander Linden Wong. I am a leader in Isaiah, and during the day, I am also a medical social worker. I work with older adults and people with disabilities who have long-term chronic health conditions. I am here tonight to testify to the stories of the elders I work with that I see repeated over and over. I work with a very diverse group of elders, African Americans, Caucasians, Africans, Asians, Native Americans, and other ethnicities, and I'm going to refer to them as my friends in this testimony because many of them have touched my lives and my life in many ways. The overwhelming majority of my elders, friends of color who I work with, worked two or three minimum wage jobs simultaneously during their adulthood. They tell me, I had no choice, I had to pay the bills. These elders tend to have more injuries and more chronic health conditions. After knowing them, I can tell you with confidence that working for the current minimum wage is bad for your health. Many of them retired or became disabled before retirement age. Moreover, because of the low wages they earned throughout their lifetime, they were unable to save for their long-term care. With their injuries and illnesses, these elders are left with no choice except to rely on the state to take care of them in their old age. Many of them end up moving from their homes into nursing homes that Mr. Pearson and Ms. Thurlow discussed in their testimony earlier. I'd like to propose to you a different vision. Instead of people losing their dignity at the end of their life, depending on the state and moving into a nursing home, why can't we give them dignity at the beginning of their life so that they never have to go there? I will leave the committee respectfully tonight with a question. Are you willing to pay my elder friends more now and give them dignity in their older age? Or are you willing to settle for them to earn lower wages now and risk losing their dignity down the road? Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the list is Brianna Halverson.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. Thank you. My name is Brianna Halverson, and I'm here representing Working America. We're an organization that works on social and economic issues. And I'm here representing our members who couldn't be here with us tonight. And they overwhelmingly support the increase of the minimum wage to $9.50 with indexing. This week, we sat down here with legislators, and some of our members shared their experience as low-wage workers. One of our members, Jim, is a father of three who lost his job during the recession. He is now working at any given time, two to three part-time low-wage jobs, and still isn't where he was making what he did before losing his job. Judith, another one of our members, is expecting her first child. She works two minimum wage jobs and is struggling to make the rent and to pay the bills. She worries every day how she will have the time with her growing family and work her jobs. She knows an increase in the wage will help her spend more time with her family, and she looks forward to that. My organization also goes out nightly all over Minnesota and talks with people at their doors. Not only do we hear their majority of them support the $9.50 bill, but we hear their stories. And people tell us that their adult children had to move back home because they weren't able to make ends meet or find a living wage job. We hear stories about the struggle that people themselves are having juggling raising their family, paying the bills, and finding one job that will be able to help them support their family. And then people who are not making minimum wage or making well above minimum wage tell us about that this is a moral issue for them and that they believe that supporting increase in the minimum wage will be good for their community and help build their community and make it strong. Like I said, the majority of our members support raising the minimum wage. In fact, around a third of those supporters tell us that they'd like to see it higher than $9.50. So I thank you for your time. I thank you for considering this bill, and I thank you for letting me share their stories.
Seeing no questions, thank you for your testimony. We will go on to Susie Brown. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Susie Brown. I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, and I'd like to start by sharing our support for the increase in the minimum wage, the House position to 950 indexed. But then I'd like to spend a minute talking to you about our sector and how we got to that position and some unique concerns that we have. In many ways, we're just like any other employer group. The pork producers or the restaurants or the Chamber of Commerce, the nonprofit sector is 10% of Minnesota's employees. And we look at this issue as one of employers and also as an issue that's unique to us as employers, because many people that we serve in the nonprofit sector are the very people whose lives would be substantially affected by an increase in the minimum wage. So in our organization, which is a statewide member organization of nonprofit employers, we've taken the last many months to think carefully about this issue using data, talking to our members, and thinking carefully about solutions to come up with our position. So a few things I'd like to tell you about our sector. Our nonprofit members really strive to provide good jobs with good pay and benefits. Often we hear about the nonprofit sector being a place with lower pay than other sectors, business or government. In some instances, that may be the truth, but actually, we do survey data frequently every other year. We have a salary survey that anybody's welcome to look at if they care to, that will show you that actually the pay in the nonprofit sector tends to be good, and there are very few positions in the nonprofit sector that pay lower than the proposed $9.50 minimum wage. So we looked at this issue. We talked to many of our members to find out how an increase in the minimum wage would affect them. In many instances, they have very small margins, as is the case with business. But overwhelmingly, our sector is in support of increasing the wage, largely because they see in the work that they do in communities that this will be good for families, will be good for kids, and will strengthen the community. There's a particular area of nonprofit service that we identified in our surveys and our conversations with our members that is problematic, and that has been raised tonight in other instances, and that has to do with disability rates. So Senator Hayden was asking for solutions and specifics. We'd like to raise the issue that the disability rates in Minnesota are, as we heard from a couple other testifiers, tend to be 95 or 97% of the revenue that goes into the organizations that provide community-based services to people with disabilities. And without raising the rates concurrently for disability service providers, these particular nonprofit organizations will have a very difficult time paying the minimum wage and staying financially, the new minimum wage if it goes to 950, and staying financially viable. We certainly are in this for the financial health and the sustainability of our members who want to provide good jobs. We're certain that all of you want to see the disability service providers in your communities be strong and be able to provide the services that the community needs. So we're strongly in support of this minimum wage increase indexed for inflation, and we ask that you take a careful look at the rate reimbursement issues related to disability services at the same time. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next on the list is Jeff Bauer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you to Mr. Bergeron, too, for managing a really long list of testifiers. We appreciate it. My name is Jeff Bauer. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Family Partnership. We are a 135-year-old organization here in the Twin Cities. Last year, we served just over 20,000 folks, and of those, about 85% were either below the poverty line or just hanging around the poverty line. And so, luckily, most people have made all the brilliant points I was going to make, so I'm just going to focus on one area that Representative Metza actually brought up with his friend, and the mental health effects of economic insecurity. So, in our counseling programs, we see nearly 10,000 people a year. And a lot of those people come in because that economic insecurity in their families has exacerbated mental health issues. So the hard data on this is that for people either at or above 200% of the federal poverty line, 6.2% of those families report suffering mental distress, and that can be anything like anxiety and depression and things like that. For folks living under 200% of the federal poverty line, that number jumps to 19.5%, almost three times as high. And so what we actually see in our programs is this plays out in a couple of ways. One of the ways is that just in family stability, in marriages, the stress that it causes to be out of work is really intense. The other thing we hear a lot is just people's frustration and depression about the fact that they can't be there for their children in terms of helping them with their schoolwork, in terms of helping them with their college educations. We get people who come through our programs all the time. So there are severe mental health consequences to economic instability. So I'm just going to leave you with one quick story. I called one of the clients at our organization named Carl and asked him if he could come down here and testify with me. And he sort of laughed when I asked him. And he said, "Are you kidding me?" And I said, "No, I really hope you can come testify." And he said, "I go home just long enough between second and third shift to kiss my kids goodnight after they're already asleep, and then I go to my next job." And I said, "Well, can I tell them anything that you'd like the committee to know?" And he said, "Tell them that I'm not making a living at all. I'm barely surviving." And so for Carl and for all the families that we work with, we would really like you to consider raising the wage to $9.50 and indexing it for inflation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bauer. Next on the list is Chris Conry.
Representative Winkler, Senator Eaton, and members of the committee, my name is Chris Conry. I'm here tonight representing Take Action Minnesota. We're a grassroots people's organization with 14,000 individual members, 26 organizational members, and offices in St. Paul, Duluth, and Grand Rapids. We're supportive of all the basic components we've been talking about tonight, raising the minimum wage to at least $9.50 an hour, adopting federal conformity. But the one thing I wanted to focus on is indexing the wage to inflation. After World War II, we built an economy in this country where workers' wages were linked to the productivity of our overall economy. As workers' productivity went up, their wages went up with it. Around 1970, this started to change. While our economy became more productive, wages for many workers stagnated. This split also happened with the minimum wage. As productivity grew, the purchasing power of the minimum wage actually fell. If the minimum wage had stayed linked to productivity, it would be over $16.54 per hour today. While indexing to inflation won't close this gap, it is a step in the right direction. Delinking workers' wages from the productivity of our overall economy has been bad for families and bad for the middle class. The relatively modest proposal in House File 92 to index to the Consumer Price Index W, or 2.5%, whichever is less, would start to return us to the more stable, more equitable arrangement we had back when the Greatest Generation was working. In short, it is a way to restore, protect, and expand the middle class in Minnesota over time. I urge you to include indexing for inflation in this year's minimum wage bill. Thank you for your time. I've also prepared a handout that illustrates some of the basic points I just made, but does it with more line graphs. So thank you for your time tonight.
Thank you. Next on the list is Ann Lott.
Good evening.
Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good evening. My name is Ann Lott. Hello, Representative Winkler and members of the committee. My name is Ann Lott. I'm from Minneapolis. Take Action. I'm here today to speak and to support raising minimum wages. As a woman, a mother, I've been employed in various jobs ranging from temp services, full and part-time, factories, assembly working positions, full-time, part-time, factories, from into housekeeping, dietary aid, home health care workers, et cetera, et cetera. Let me tell you what it's like dealing with sick children, doctor's appointments, school functioning, basics, responsibility as a mother and a parent. I know that I'm not alone in this struggle. It's people like me, myself, and other people dealing with these issues 365 days a year. But the good news is today, my seven children are exceptional. One is an RN, one is making a career in the Navy, one is studying to become an engineer. My life has since changed. I had to start over studying to become a licensed CNA and then moving on to LPN. I'm here today in favor of raising minimum wages for myself and other mother and parents who couldn't make it here today. Please, I ask of all of you to keep mothers, parents, people like myself in your minds while making this decision. The cost of living is steady going up. Please raise minimum wages to $9.50. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lott. Mm-hmm. Next is Dan Kitzberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dan Kitzberger. I'm the policy director with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. And on behalf of our nearly 200 members statewide and the thousands of Minnesotans they serve, I'd like to express our support for a $9.50 minimum wage indexed to inflation. I'd like to talk, if I could, about the housing affordability gap, which is the balance between what housing costs and how much households are able to pay for it. People experiencing homelessness face challenges on both sides of this equation. In essence, homelessness is often a math problem. For some context, a bit of data from the Wilder Statewide Homelessness Survey in 2012. 24% of the homeless population are working. On average, they work about 27 hours a week and earn $800 a month. Two-thirds report earning less than $10 an hour. Housing is considered affordable at no more than 30% of a household's income. The American Community Survey tells us that over the last decade, rent has risen about 8% statewide, while median renter income has dropped 14%. According to the Minnesota Housing Partnership's 2013 Out of Reach report, a Minnesota household earning minimum wage must work an average of 89 hours a week to afford a two-bedroom apartment at fair market rent. This is the worst among Midwestern states. If we raise the minimum wage to $9.50 an hour, it would reduce that to 68 hours a week and bump us up to second best in the Midwest. So to close the affordability gap for housing, we can do two things. We can increase the supply of affordable housing, or we can increase a household's income that's available for housing. We're working hard to increase the supply of affordable housing in Minnesota, and we've made some great strides in recent years. And it's time we make some progress on the other side of the equation by raising the minimum wage to $9.50 and indexing it to inflation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. It's my understanding that Ms. Estes is no longer here or interested in testifying, and so Laura Nevitt is next on our list. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Laura Nevitt, and I'm from St. Paul. Thank you, Representative Winkler and the committee, for letting me testify today. Some of you know me in many different roles, and I wear many different hats in my community, but today I am here on behalf of my family. I live in St. Paul, and I'm a graduate student, and I travel up to UMD to the MAPL program every weekend. I have three nieces and two sisters. We are a family full of women. As was testified earlier by Erin Parrish with the Women's Consortium, I won't go through the data of the impact specifically on women, but I want to talk about the impact specifically on the women in my family. I have a sister who lives in poverty, and this fall she will have to leave her house that she has lived in and raised her children because she can't find a job that pays a living wage. She can find a job that pays her a poverty wage, but it will not keep her in her house. I have a niece who is 23 years old and is in college and will go out and live on her own for the very first time this year. And she struggles with the idea of whether or not she will actually be able to afford to do that because she works for a hobby company that barely pays her a minimum wage. I will graduate from a master's program this fall unemployed. And I worry that with that amount of debt I have taken on for school, and I've enjoyed every minute of it, will I be able to find a job that helps me provide for my family? I encourage you today
to vote to increase our minimum wage. When I moved to Minnesota 23 years ago, one of the things I loved about this state was that it took care of its people. It was important and paramount when policymakers made decisions that they took care of the people here in Minnesota. It is imperative today that we make sure that no one in Minnesota lives in poverty. And we can solve that problem right now by raising a minimum wage. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Nevitt. It's my understanding that Ms. Poole is going to wait and save her testimony. And so the last I have on my list is Catherine Mullen. And after Ms. Mullen, I will ask if anybody else is here who would like to testify tonight. But as of right now, you are the last word.
That's exciting. My name is Catherine Mullen. I am the public policy and outreach coordinator for the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the public policy voice of the Catholic Church and the bishops in Minnesota. The MCC wishes to express its support for an increase in Minnesota's minimum wage. The social doctrine of the church emphasizes both a person's right to work and their responsibility to work. That work, however, must be compensated by just wages that provide access to the basic necessities of a person and his or her family. When civil society fails to provide access to just wages for all persons, the state, as an instrument of justice, may set the minimum wage rate. The bishops of Minnesota don't pretend to be economists, but they are pastors, and the church does oversee the largest non-governmental network of health, education, and charitable ministries in the state. What we can tell you from firsthand experience is that it is becoming increasingly difficult for the working poor of our state to make ends meet, and a raise in the minimum wage would directly address this growing problem. By no means do we question the intentions or motivations of those who oppose an increase in minimum wage. We also believe that the needs of small businesses should be considered. Small businesses cannot absorb the cost of minimum wage increase in the same way that larger businesses can. But it is our hope that we can come together for some sort of action to address the problems facing the lowest wage earners in our state. We believe an increase in minimum wage is a matter of fairness and justice. We urge continued consideration of these and other ways compatible with a healthy economy to support workers' income. And we thank you very much for your time, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Thank you. Ms. Mullen, I had an email last year from former Representative Rukavina, who told me that the last time he got the minimum wage passed, he got the support of the Pope. And so much has happened since that time, but I gather you're not speaking on behalf of Pope Francis.
I'm pretty sure he'd support this, actually. Just saying, I could call him and find out, but.
Is there anybody else? Thank you. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to be heard this evening? Seeing nobody step forward, thank you very much. Representative Eaton, do you have any comments about schedule going forward? You have the gavel tomorrow.
I call you.
Yeah. It's late.
I think what we're planning is meeting at 3:00 in room 107 in the Capitol, and it would probably be a short meeting. I know that Representative Winkler needs to leave at 4:00. So my hope is that we can hear from Deed and Dolly and anybody else who didn't get to testify tonight that shows up. Up to an hour, but hopefully a short meeting.
Thank you. Seeing nothing further, the committee is adjourned.